All right, well, we are here interviewing Colin Diedrich at the University of Pittsburgh. It's June 19th, 2017. Lead interviewer is myself, Jessica Martucci, and assisted by Greg Waters. And we're here from the Chemical Heritage Foundation as part of our Scientists with Disabilities Oral History Project. So thank you, Colin, for agreeing to be interviewed by us.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, I'm just going to start off at the beginning, which is where we usually start, and ask about when and where you were born and who your parents were and all that sort of background stuff.
Okay. So I was born in St. Louis in 1983. And my parents are Vicky and Tom Diedrich, and my mom is an artist, and my dad was vice president of a wholesale company that my grandfather actually started. And I also have a twin sister and an older brother, and that's the very basic stuff.
All right, well, tell me a little bit more about your parents' backgrounds. So you said your mom is an artist.
My mom's an artist.
Did she go to school to train, or is she self-taught?
Yeah, so she went to KU, so Kansas University, and she actually got a degree in occupational therapy, but always loved painting, and I think she used some of that artist stuff in some of her occupational therapy. And so she did that for years until my older brother was born, I think, and where she was able to be full-time stay-at-home mom. And she always painted. And her and my grandfather actually, my grandfather's a woodworker, and so not only did he start this business that my dad worked for and his other sons too, but my grandfather was this woodworker, and him and my mom would have this like Vicky and Dad art where they, my grandfather would, it was sculptures, and so my grandfather would make woodworkings, whether it was just like things to hang or just like little tchotchkes and stuff, and my mom would paint them and stuff. So that was pretty cool. And my grandmother owned an art gallery for a while, and they all sold stuff there and did that. So that was basically all the things that my mom was doing, I think, when all of us were growing up. Now she's playing grandma really hard, which is pretty sweet. And my dad, he got a general studies degree. And I'm laughing because it's funny. It's my dad, general studies. And my mom and dad met in college, so they met at KU. And then he started working for my grandfather, and so then they were able to just have a pretty decent business for years. And my dad just retired last year, and he is grandpa-ing really hard. And not my kids. I don't have kids, but my siblings all have kids, so they like that a lot. And so that's just the basic, I think, basics of my mom and dad.
When were your parents born? And were they born in St. Louis?
My dad was born in 1953. I think I have these dates right. 53 in either some city in Kansas. Maybe, I don't know if it was. Was it Lawrenceville? Is that where KU is?
Sounds about
something.
Right.
Some place in Kansas.
Yeah.
He grew up in, maybe it was Kansas City. I'm not sure. And my mom was born in St. Louis.
Okay.
So I have a lot of family in St. Louis where I grew up.
And when was your mom's birthday?
1955.
Okay. And what was your mother's maiden name?
Ginsburg.
And so her whole family is from the St. Louis area? Is that what you
said? Yeah. Or like lived there for decades and decades.
Yeah.
And pretty much everyone is still there.
Mm-hmm. And do you mind telling me a little bit more about your is it your paternal grandparents that had the business?
Oh, maternal.
Yes,
okay. My mom's parents.
So your mom's parents. And so had they been native Missourians, or had they come there from somewhere else?
Yes, their parents, so my great-grandparents, they immigrated from, I think, Russia. I'm not totally sure. And my grandparents have been, they were both in St. Louis for, I mean, they've been in St. Louis their whole lives. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather has really interesting stories and stuff, and you asked about the company?
Mm-hmm.
And so he went through, like, his father owned a few local shops, like, in St. Louis, that were pretty successful, like, on, like, a local level. And so he got his bearings, I think, from my great-grandfather, which I never met her, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then through, I don't know, a handful of different, like, circumstances, and, like, over the next, like, few decades after my grandfather was working for his dad, and after he served time and was in the Korean War for a bit, but when he came back, he started a few different wholesale companies, and it was literally just like buying, when companies make too much stuff and they can't sell it, my grandfather would say, I'll buy it for super cheap, and then he sells it for cheap, you know, that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, he did that, and that company went through a handful of, he had to start a few companies at a few different times because of, like, he, like, sold it at one point, but sold it for unregistered stock at one point, and so then there was, like, an issue with that, and then everything fell through and didn't have the company. So it was one of those things, and he had to start over again, and mm-hmm. he ended up with a company called Closeouts with Class, and that was the one that has been around for maybe, I don't know if it's, like, 30 years, but maybe a long time. And we have to say that, like, we, as in, like, my siblings and cousins and stuff, have been so fortunate. We understand, like, our privilege of, like, you know, like, our parents were able to pay for our college. And so, like, that's something that, like, most people don't have, right? And so, and it was all really because of my grandpa, you know, and starting this company and stuff. And it recently closed, like, last year. And so that was really, really hard. But, you know, he was able to give a pretty good life to his kids and grandkids and stuff. So
cool.
Yeah.
And so what about your dad's family? Are they part of your life at all?
Not as much now. It was hard because they lived in Kansas City or Lawrenceville. Wait, where does Lawrence... wherever
KU is.
Asking
the wrong person, yeah. We'll fact check
something.
That.
Whatever. Yeah, fact check my inability to know where family members live or where KU is located. It was really nice. We were able to go see them. I like Christmas time. I grew up Jewish, but they are some Christian sect. I don't know. And I know it's funny. People ask me, and I'm like, I was like, well, they're Christian. I'm like, what? It's all the same, right? And apparently, it's not. But we would always go and celebrate Christmas with them, which I thought was nice. And so, like, that was pretty cool. But again, it was harder because, like, we see my mom's side of the family, you know, we would see them once a week. We actually did family dinners once a week, you know, all growing up, and even when we all go back in town and stuff. And then, you know, my dad's side of the family, we saw just a lot less and stuff, so. That's definitely, I think, a big difference.
Yeah.
Of, just, like, geography, mm-hmm. really.
So, what year were you born? So your parents met in college and then moved. Did they get married when they were still in college and then decided to move?
I think
they
got married after college.
Okay.
I'm sure they did. And so they were at KU but moved back to St. Louis, or my mom moved to St. Louis and my dad moved with her. And so I was born in 83.
And you were... you were a twin.
A twin, yeah.
And you have an older brother.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So, when was your oldest brother born?
He was born in 81.
Okay.
And
what's his name?
His name is Justin. And yeah, so it's my older brother. Just like a little background, I guess, about my brother and sister. My brother's super smart, and he's like the super smart one in the family, and he. Was always, like, really interested in, and I guess is really interested in like how things work and stuff. And he actually ended up going to medical school, and so he's a clinician now, and he lives in California and stuff. And so it was pretty cool being able to grow up with, you know, Justin, seeing all the kind of the cool stuff that he did. And then also all of the teachers really liked Justin, so then when the twins were coming up, we always had like an extra advantage part of that when you have a good older brother. And then my twin sister, she's also super smart, and my brother and sister, we both were all like really close. I think something that's a little different with Carrie, or my twin's name is Carrie, is that, you know, we were always in classes together, or in the same grade and stuff, and so we'd hang out, and we always got along really well, and still do, and so I think the first time that we were ever really apart was in college, and so that was one thing where I was like, oh, Carrie's not going to be around, that's weird, and she ended up going to Maryland Institute College of Art, and I guess I didn't say this, but my brother went to Case Western, for med school. And so my sister went to MICA, and she majored in like sculpting and printmaking, I think. And she ended up, after she graduated, she ended up moving to Xi'an, China for a year to volunteer there with our brother-in-law. They were just dating at the time. And then he applied to law schools while he was in Xi'an, and applied and actually got in at Pitt. And so I was currently here in 2006, and so I really wanted him to get in here and decided to go here. And so for the 4 years that he was here, because he got a dual degree, so it took 4 years, I was also in graduate school. So there was this nice overlap where it was like, oh, I didn't think this was ever going to happen again. Which that was pretty cool. And so, yeah, so we're all pretty close, really close with my siblings. And it's also pretty cool, too, that they, my sister and brother, they both have two kids. So it's nice because, I don't know, my wife and I, we're not thinking about kids very much. Mm-hmm. So it's nice that there are these little ones running around. And then when they're too wild and stuff, we can go to your parents and then go and watch TV or drink or something irresponsible.
Right. So you you mentioned like having a pretty extended family and lots of cousins and like family dinner once a week. So were there any, I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about some of the influence of your extended family on your childhood?
So we were all really close, and my grandparents and my one set of cousins and aunt and uncle and us, we all lived on the same street, and we were always like really physically close to each other, and we also got along really well, which was fortunate. And I think it was always nice though that we did a lot more together as a family than I realized was normal. And this wasn't until like my senior year of high school that I was taking one of those like senior transition classes. It's just like a joke. And I remember the teacher at the time was like, oh, who here has dinner with their family, you know, at least once a week? And I was like, of course, we do it 5 days a week. Or like 6 days maybe. And then he kept going up and up, and my hand was the only one up. And I'm like, what is going on? this is weird? Like, I'm the weird one? Like, everybody else is weird. And so my nuclear family, we always have dinner together, and we're always like pretty close. And then the extended family would do dinner. It ended up being like on Sunday nights, that was really awesome. I think I've always been impressed with my like grandfather's like work ethic and how he like created a business and it was successful enough to like essentially, you know, employ I don't actually know numbers, but I don't know, 50, 100 people maybe. And you know, we never wanted anything. And that was all, I think, really because of him. And also I think just always being able to confide in just a bunch of different people for different things. I just think that that's always been really, just really nice. Even with like my cousins that are younger, you know, I have some like 21-year-old cousins, and then I have some maybe 36-year-old cousins. You know, I'm 33, so there's like a wide range.
And you mentioned that you were raised Jewish. So was your mother? Was it your mother's family?
That yeah, was yeah. Jewish? So is that side so Jewish? Yeah, yeah.
And so, how much of a part of your life was
very?
Was that?
Oh, we got B'nai Mitzvah. So my sister and I, we did that, and so that was when we were 13, and like High Holy Day Jews. That was as how my family is. I am not religious anymore, but I take like pride in my Judaism, more like ethnically, where like I feel like, you know, it's your responsibility as a Jew, whether you believe it or not, to like make sure people aren't persecuted, you know, and it's just really hard, especially in today's world. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing where it's like, you know, I think that I never really felt, or I haven't felt very Jewish in a really long time, more than just like ethnically, mm-hmm. Until, you know, really like lately, where I'm like, oh, this is, there's a lot of things that are happening, and, you know, and I don't, you know, nobody deserves to be persecuted, and I get extra offended, especially when Jews are really horrible to Muslims, and I'm just like, you, it's like, your job is to make sure that persecution never happens. Don't do that,
right.
You know. And so, yeah, anyway, so I think that's one thing I think that I've just really, you know, taken with me. But I have to say that, honestly, like, religion is just not a big part of my life.
Was it important to your mother's generation? Like, do you think it's kind of decreased over time? Or
I do think it's decreased over time, but probably within the average decrease over right. in Americans, right? My mom is very spiritual, like, we joke a lot, like, she's, everything's God's miracle, you know, and just, she has, like, teal hair stripe, and she's, mom's awesome, she's, like, this spiritual hippie weirdo lady, but it's my mom, so super cool, she's just very much, like, look, she's like, she'll be like, Colin, look at this stick bug. This stick bug is, and this is how she's talking, like, this stick bug, this is a miracle. How could God make this? This is a miracle. It looks like a stick. And I'm like, Mom. I'm like, but that's evolution. Yeah, it hides well. It looks like a stick. And then another thing we do, this is just because my mom's awesome. She also will regularly tell me that, that snowflakes are miracles, just because they're cool. And she's an artist, just like, you know, all the shapes and stuff. And she's like, no two snowflakes are alike, and just very fun about that. And that's one thing that I think is real funny, and like that I've had to like adjust, because I was like, Mom, I think you need to raise your threshold on miracle. But it's like, well, if someone can like get this much joy out of life, which is something that I think I really have taken from my mom, where we would say, tell her that she's like, sucks the marrow out of life. She's like one of those, if you have chicken, she's vegetarian now, but like, you break the chicken and suck the marrow out, super gross. It was like kind of delicious, but, and so she's like, she like sucks the marrow out of life. And then my dad wasn't very religious. He never converted to Judaism, but for all intents and purposes, when we were raised Jewish, and he probably considers himself Jewish, like, you know, as much as, I don't know. I just tell people I'm just not a very good Jew, so.
Was there a substantial Jewish community in St. Louis, or was it something that was sort of marginal in that culture?
You know, it wasn't until college that I realized that there weren't a lot of Jews around, and so I think it was substantial in the suburbs, in like the upper middle class suburbs that where like I grew up, and like we always had a lot of Jewish friends, not because they were Jewish, but like because it was we must have met because of I think Sher Hameth was our synagogue, excuse me, and I think we met there, and then or like the parents met or something, but you know, I had like a really good core group of friends, you know, all from like elementary school, all through high school and stuff. And I didn't realize how odd it was that a lot of them were Jewish too, are Jewish, were Jewish, you know. And so, yeah, that's definitely one thing that's, I don't know, this is a little different, I guess.
Mm. So did you do any extracurricular sort of activities as a child, like Boy Scouts or camping or sports?
Yeah, so I was always very active. I was the kid that had too much energy and was really wild and rambunctious and did everything I could for attention. And so I think that kind of like pushed me more towards sports. And I was never great at any sports, but I always had a lot of endurance. And it wasn't until, I think in middle school, I started to run. And I wasn't good at running, I ran in middle school and high school, and I ran in college, and it was all cross country. I also wrestled for a little bit in high school, and I went on the swim team. And even after that, I was on the pom-pom squad at my high, you know, pom-poms?
No.
Yeah. Well, they have those little fluffy thing.
Oh, the fluffy
pom. Okay. Yeah, pom. I learned that it's called pom pom. So
okay.
I was on the dance team for a season or two. I did that for attention. And in high school, I'm kind of jumping around. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
So in high school, I was joking with a friend of mine that I was going to try out for the team because there weren't any guys on it. And then the principal of the school found out I was doing it, and she found out I was doing it as a joke and told me not to. And so then I was like, well, now I have to. So I did it with a friend of mine, Aaron, and we did it. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. We got the attention that we wanted. I guess I feel like I'm 33, I can admit, like, sometimes you do things for attention. And so that was fun. You know, I enjoyed it, but I think my biggest passion, like extracurricular, was always running. I mean, that's the thing that kind of like really leads me to, it gives me my focus, it helps me just like get through the day. And also, I really like the idea of in running, I really like the ability to, you can like literally push yourself until you can't anymore. And those are things that I really like thrive on. It's something that like is tangible and physical. And it's like, oh, can I push myself until I throw up? Or can I push myself until I literally can't go any further? You know, like those things. And which I think is like in the running community, those things are like, oh, yeah, this is kind of cool. Yeah, do that. And then on the outside, it's like, why would you run to hurt yourself? And I was like, because I wanted to see if I could. And I did. So I think that it's mostly running. Running then and now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'm going to start asking questions about school.
Okay.
So did you go to like a preschool program, or were you at home until kindergarten? When did you first enter school?
You know, I think I was in preschool. I think it was Lucky Day. I think that's what it was called. And I'm pretty sure I was in class with Ozzie Smith. He was a cardinal, with his kid or grandkid, or maybe kid. I think, because that was a big deal. I never watched sports and didn't really care. But I think parents liked that. I did that preschool, and then just public school throughout.
Mm-hmm. And so how were your early schooling experiences?
I was more conflicted, mm-hmm. I think. Let's see here. And I'll have to like double check all the dates and stuff. But it was very clear that I wasn't reading at the level I should be. And in first grade, one of my teachers, Mrs. Tucker, she went and talked to my parents about this, or she talked to my mom and was like, look, you know, I think Colin is like, he's behind in reading, and I want to tutor him in the summer. And so then that was my first like taste of like getting tutored and stuff. Cause I always tried really, really hard, and like my sister, things come naturally to her, and my brother as well. And they were always super smart, and I wanted to be smart like them. And so I always just like wanted to learn more. But there was this words are just hard for me still, and they were really hard back then when I didn't understand why, like, I was adding in sentences or, like, adding in words or adding in letters or taking them out or truncating them or pushing them together. You know, there was all these things I was doing with letters I didn't really understand and my parents didn't understand. And so that was in first grade that I went with Mrs. Tucker. And Mrs. Tucker was wonderful, and she tutored me in reading and writing all summer long. And then it was in second grade, I it was a newer teacher, and I was in class with, like, all my friends, and like I said before, I was, like, really rambunctious and wild and stuff, and it doesn't just go away. and so that, like, continued, and me being wild and not paying attention, and I really lost a lot of the progress I made reading-wise. And so then when my parents found out about that, then that's when they were pretty pissed off. And they ended up getting me private tutoring or at school. So, like, for, like, our home period or whatever the period was, I was taken out of class and I would literally just work on reading, and that helped me get back up to where I was, like, at least in the summer. And then, so, like, reading and writing has always been really difficult. Spelling. I remember times where I was in, like, a music class, and I remember breaking down and, like, having a panic attack when I was in first, second, or third grade, I don't know, where, you know, one of my friends was like, "Colin, what's going on?" And I was just so worried about the time test. Remember those little multiplication tables, and you just have to, I mean, it's not tables, but the multiplication test where there's, like, 100, and then you just answer as many as you can.
Yeah.
And it went horrible. It was a nightmare. And so I remember, you know, I specifically remember that, because that's just something, like, I just don't process information that fast. And, like, I knew it, but I didn't really understand why. And then it wasn't until, I think it must have been in third grade, that my mom was given advice that I get privately tested, because she didn't want to initially. And she got me tested for learning disabilities, but, like, was able to cover the $1,000 or $2,000 cost that, you know, that it was. And then I was, like, officially diagnosed, which was helpful. But the school, like, I think this was in elementary school at this time, like, they didn't accept it. And so then I had to get privately tutored through the school using the diagnosis that my mom was able to get me. I got tested and I was given my diagnosis, and I don't know what the actual diagnosis was then, but, you know, written expression issues, reading disorder, I'm sure it was within that realm. I was trying to get, or my parents were trying to get me through an IEP. And so they were trying to get me the individual plan. And, like, by that time I was already seeing a tutor weekly that was helping me study. And I was always studying a lot. And so I was passing all my classes, and I was, like, a B and A student. And so the school said that, like, I didn't deserve accommodations because I wasn't failing. And so then, so that was really difficult. And so then what my mom had to do, and she did a lot of this, like, on, like, in the background, you know, which I wasn't, you know, privy to at the time, I don't think. But she was the one who was, like, you know, she, like, fought with, like, administration over this. And so then eventually I was still able to get accommodations. And it's difficult because, like, you know, when you're a kid, you know, I've had this really positive environment, like, growing up and stuff. And, but, like, you know, when a school says, "Oh, no, you can only get accommodations, you know, if you're doing poorly," then essentially that means that, like, "Oh, well, you're dumb," or, like, "You're not," you know. And so that's the stuff that you, like, internalize. Mm-hmm. And so then, yeah, so that was really difficult. But I kind of leaned into a lot of these, my learning disabilities and stuff. I was always able to get with the tutor that I was seeing, and she was a special ed tutor, you know, and the techniques that I learned, you know, and over 12 years, I mean, from, like, first grade to 12th grade, I think I saw this specific tutor from third grade to 12th grade. You know, I feel like that was the best thing that, like, prepared me for everyday life, really, and work. But like academically, like things were always harder. I had to spend more time. But I was always the student that did my homework, and I always like worked really hard, and I always wanted to get good grades. And it was like similar to like what I was saying about running, is like pushing myself, because reading was always so hard. I would like push myself and be like, oh, can I get an A on this test? And it, a lot of times it wasn't for like the, like learning the material. It was just like, oh, well, I just want to prove it to myself. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I really wasn't that passionate about any coursework, I don't think. I just liked learning generally. And so that was like academic stuff. So it was hard and stressful, but I feel like through the help that I received and my family, that was it. That was good. And you know, and like there were times too where my parents, you know, my parents and I would fight a lot, or like even with my siblings, even most of my, I guess my parents, about like homework and doing work and stuff, and they didn't understand why things were taking me so long. And it wasn't until they met with one of the psychologists that diagnosed me. It wasn't until then that the psychologist was like, all right, you guys no longer are allowed to do homework with Colin. You know, it wasn't until then. And so then it was one of those moments where it was like, oh, you know, we don't understand, you know, like they didn't understand what was going on.
Right.
And that's when they like were able to like hire, I guess this is third grade, because that's when they hired Kathy, who's my tutor for, you know, 9 years, I guess. Yeah, so that was really helpful, and also I think it helped our relationship, because I remember times like, you know, reading and, you know, my parents not understanding what, like, why are you adding words? Why aren't you paying attention? You know, I remember fighting with my dad about that, and mm-hmm. or like getting really frustrated with my mom and stuff. And so it's hard when like the people that are helping you the most, and then you like turn on them, you know. And so like, at that time I didn't realize it, but the tutor was really helpful with that.
Yeah. And so you stayed with the same tutor throughout your elementary and into high school
years. Yeah.
What were the things that she, you know, tools wise, what did she give you that was helpful? Or was it just about the like extra time?
Well, I think it was more than that. It was learning different study skills. I think the primary thing was, hey, it's okay you have learning disabilities, which I feel like that's like the foundation of, hey, if you want to, I don't like really like the term overcoming your learning disability, because it doesn't go away. But if you're going to work with your disability or overcome it or to work with it despite your learning disabilities, you're getting this stuff, but it's not even despite, it's you have these learning disabilities and you can also be successful. But the first step of that is like saying it's okay that you have this. And also at that time she wasn't saying like, hey, you're not good at reading. It's like, oh, you can be better at reading, you know, and that, you know, that type of mentality I think was really helpful. And so that was like really important. Another thing though that was important with that is the study skills that I learned, and they were very obsessive, or I became very obsessive over them, which I had to do. And it was highlighting in certain colors, and it was like blue is a definition, or is a vocab word, and orange is a definition. Yellow is just a normal fact, and orange right after yellow describes the fact more in depth, or orange after a definition describes that, you know, word. And so then I would have, you know, my... I was always very good at highlighting. You know, when the kids first learn, it's always, everything's highlighted, and it's just completely... I was always very good at it, and I can, like, just look at the page, and then I would say, oh, okay, these are the vocab words I need to know, and then I would make flashcards, or these are just the general facts and stuff. And so I was making flashcards and highlighting and stuff, you know, in elementary school, and I took that all the way through high school. Mm-hmm. And so I think those were some of, like, the major things... And just understanding that I need to be in a distraction or reduced environment, I mm-hmm. think that's really important as well, you know. And it's just, I think a lot of that, and always, I was also always held like accountable for my work. And that was always really important, I think, too, because I didn't wanna upset Kathy. And so then it was like, oh, I need to make sure I have all my homework done. And I think there was a rule, and I can't totally remember this, but I think there was a rule with Kathy saying that we weren't, like, the whole point wasn't to do homework with her. It was have the homework done and have, like, the few questions that you need. And so it was very, like, stringent stuff. But, yeah, I think that's very, very, that was very helpful.
And when you were getting tutoring, it sounds like in the beginning it was really focused exclusively on reading. Did it change over time as your subjects grew, or was it always reading focused?
Well, reading and writing, mm-hmm. both. I think that was, those were the primary focus focuses. And then I think with just like more memorization stuff, you know, because a lot of high school is just, when did this war happen? Who fought in it? It's all just, you have to just repeat things verbatim. And so then that stuff was really difficult. And so then it was, okay, you got to make flashcards, or you have to write down these notes. And, oh, well, if I'm not learning by just looking at the flashcards, I learn better when I write it out. And so then I would just rewrite stuff again and again, just to get the names right. And so, yeah, so I think it probably progressed, but the majority of it, I think, was reading. But I can't remember, like, when I was in high school going to Kathy, if we would sit down and just, like, read passages. I don't think that was the case. Mm-hmm. I think that it was like, oh, I don't understand this. Can you explain this to me, you know, in the homework that we were doing, mm-hmm. I think.
Was Kathy specifically trained to work with students with disabilities?
She was a special ed teacher. So I think so. I'm not totally sure. But other parents from these other organizations I'm working with ask me that question too, because I guess now with things are so specific. Mm-hmm.
So were there any favorite subjects of yours in elementary school, like before you went into high school? Did you enjoy any particular subject over any
other? I always really liked history. I think those were my favorite. That was my favorite for a really long time. And it was just like what happened. I still have some like drawings of like the Boston Tea Party. They're very poor drawings, but they're also kind of amazing. I always really liked history, and then even high school, I think I liked it a lot more. I always wanted to understand how things worked, and so then that's the sciences and stuff were interesting to me, but there was nothing special. Honestly, and I didn't, I don't know, I was always so active. I liked gym a lot. I wish I had a gym class now, right? it was really pretty broad, but I think history was really, that was the subject I really liked.
Hmm. And what did you do during the summers when you were a kid, before you were working age?
So I still got tutored all summer. That was very important. My tutor, or Kathy, she would give us homework. For a while, I was going to tutoring. It was like one of my friends and I, a friend who have similar learning disabilities. And so that was interesting. And then for a bunch of summers, there was a sleepaway camp called Camp Sabra. And that was a Jewish camp. So I've always been surrounded by a lot of Jews, I think. And so that was really cool. And that was probably from elementary school through early high school, I think. And that was always a lot of fun. And so all of us, the Jewish kids would all go to that camp. And it was like a two-week to a month-long sleepaway camp, which was always pretty cool. So a lot of like activities and stuff to do. And then I think really just mostly for summers, I was just trying to be like really active and stuff, you know.
So when you went to middle school, oftentimes middle school is like a rough time for everyone. Was middle school rough for you,
you know,
at all?
And this is sad, because I joke a lot about my wife about this, is that school, I was always very well liked. And I always had like a bunch of acquaintances and a handful of like good friends and a few people I really, you know, I was real close with. And so it wasn't. And like, I can't, like, I understand that. But school, socially for me, school wasn't, was never that bad, honestly. And I think beyond the normal awkward, I don't know how old you are, 12 or 13, 14, whatever old you are in middle school, like that stuff. And when you're a really wild kid, getting in trouble, but I always, I would get in trouble, but I never did anything, I don't know, that bad, I don't think. But it was just being really obnoxious or like having any issues with authority and stuff. But issues with authority up until I'm actually going to get in trouble. And that was like, in middle school, really. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so I honestly feel like I was just really fortunate in that respect, really.
And all through the sort of early part of your childhood before high school, as you were sort of going through all of this with, you know, confronting and learning to deal with your learning disability, you'd mentioned, you know, that your brother and sister were both like really, really smart and that things came pretty easily to them.
Yeah.
Did that create like tensions or,
you know,
like disagreements in the household because you had to work really, really hard to get your work done and they were sort of like,
sure,
I'm finished and now I'm going to go out and
well,
play?
So here's an example, I think. Since I was always so wild, this was, I guess, when I was in middle school, or I'm still wild, but like I can contain it. I can fake it. But I think in elementary school, you know, I was always really wild and stuff and rambunctious. And so my parents started like a sticker program where I had a big poster and I was like, did you do this thing sticker? Did you do this? And so I had the sticker thing and I would get a prize, you know, so they had to essentially bribe me, you know, as upper middle class, a white Jewish family does. They did that, and I remember where my parents remember, and they would tell me that, like, you know, Carrie and Justin would be like, well, why is Colin get prizes, you know? And my parents would be like, well, this is good for Colin. Like, Colin needs this, so just, like, back off, normal kids. So that was one thing. Dad tells the story about us, like, I don't know, he was doing, like, yard work, and I was, like, trying to help or something. We were outside, and this is elementary school, some, I don't know, maybe like fourth or fifth grade, maybe. And he tells a story about, like, we were talking about Justin and Carrie and how Justin was always so smart, and my sister is really smart. She's also, like, this incredible artist. Like, she's always been able to, you know, when she was really little, she was drawing way better than she should have been able to. It was like that thing, or sketching, or whatever it's called. And so we were talking about that, and I remember my dad tells me, because I don't remember this actual story, but he was like, you looked up at me and you were like, so if Justin's really smart and Carrie's so good at art, like, what am I good at? You know, and when my dad tells the story, he gets choked up, which is funny because he's very waspy, so I'm like, eh. So I like when he tells the story, it's funny. I don't remember what he told me that day. But I think one thing, though, is, like, he was always saying that, like, I was always really good with people, like, understanding people and stuff and could get along with people and stuff like that, which I didn't understand that was a skill set until I started actually working. And, like, that is a skill set, and I'm glad I have that. But it was nice, and I joke with my dad that it was good that he was able to think on his feet. So there clearly were times that I had issues, or like I wanted to be like them, and I think even like there were times too when, you know, my sister, she made the 100 absences club, and she got a 4.0 her senior year. And so if you miss like 100, like we had block courses, so it was like 3 courses one day and 4 courses the next day. So if you miss 100 of those, then you become on the 100 absentee, whatever idiot thing she wanted to get. And so she got it. So she's super smart, and she was able to skip a lot of classes and stuff. But that was stuff that I never did. And so I think that there's probably some envy that I had to that, to be like, wait a minute, why could you do that? And she would, like, skip stuff to go to, like, the art room to do art things or hang out with her boyfriend, who is now her husband and brother-in-law. So, but yeah, so I think that there definitely were times, but I think we were always involved in such different things. My brother, it was clear he wanted to go into, he wanted to be a clinician early on and wanted to do doctor things. My sister always was into art, and I just really like sports and like running and whatever. And so it was, we never really, our interests never really collided. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so anyway, so I think that like we're all pretty close, and I don't think there was much animosity there, but like from some of the stuff that my dad said, that there clearly was, but it didn't leave that big of a mark on me, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. So I think, could you send me several things that you've written about your life, because you had mentioned that you're working on a memoir.
Yeah.
And so at one point, I think you mentioned when you transitioned into middle school or high school, there were problems with getting the school to actually provide the services that you needed.
Yeah, yeah.
So could you talk a little bit more about that?
Oh, so that was, I'm not totally sure on all the dates of it, but I had my diagnosis. So I had my, at that time I had my, the school diagnosis from elementary school, but you need to get retested. And so they didn't want to retest me because I was getting A's and B's. And so then that was stuff where my mom had to fight for that. And then eventually I ended up, there was a meeting with my mom and dad and the administration and some head people, and my tutor came in, because this was all supposed to be like IEP stuff, where I was going to get like the individual plan that was specific to my needs and like the reasonable accommodations. And they still didn't want to give me accommodations. And so then my mom went to the head of special services of Parkway School District and was like, look, like my son's diagnosed and he deserves these accommodations and you're not getting him accommodations. And so then he told my mom that she was just the standard, it's a very jerk thing to say. It was something like, oh, you're just a typical West County mother, which is the area I grew up in, upper middle class area. You're the typical West County mother that can't accept the fact that her son has a low IQ. And so my mom screams at him, like, well, what if my son has a high IQ but is, you know, has learning disabilities, and like stormed out and went directly to whoever his boss was, because like the head, went to like the head district, which was, and like refused to leave until this person, whoever, I don't remember who she was, saw my mom. And then my mom was like, look, like I, whatever this guy's name was, I can't remember, you know, said that I couldn't do this. We have these accommodations that he's supposed to get. The school doesn't want to do this. I need this meeting now. And so then it was like the following week or something. And so everything was set up. We were able, or I was able to get like those accommodations. And what was so important with those accommodations in high school, I needed to have like a documented accommodations if I wanted to get them in college. Mm. And so then after that meeting, I think I had to get diagnosed again in order for that diagnosis to carry over for college. So I was diagnosed three times, I think, maybe four times for it. Yeah. So by separate people. Yeah. One thing's hard with like invisible disabilities just in general is that like it's hard to prove. You know, and there can be a lot of like subjectiveness to it. But one issue that I think in the learning disability space is that, you know, why do you have to keep re-getting tested? And just fast-forwarding, a few decades, like I started taking classes here for a certificate in disability law studies, and it's through the law school. And when I met with the disability office, they told me, they were like, well, you know, we don't still have your old disability stuff on file because we throw that away after 5 years or 7 years. So when I first came here in 2006, and they said, okay, so yeah, you can still get accommodations, But if you want to get, if you want to like turn the certificate into a master's, so it's 15 credits versus 30 credits, then you'll probably have to get diagnosed again. And I was like, it doesn't, I was like, you guys accepted my diagnosis. Learning disabilities don't go away. And it would be, you know, $1,500 out of my pocket if I got tested again. Or maybe a little more or less, I don't know. And so it's just one of those things where it's like, there are these, the way the law has it, and a lot of policies in universities is that, you know, you're only allowed to, or like, the diagnosis exists for a certain number of years. But like, at what point, when you're an adult, does it not? You know, and so I think that's one thing that I've always like had to deal with. But I've been fortunate with my college, my undergrad and graduate school, and coming back here, Pitt's pretty good about it. So,
wow, I didn't realize that it was an out-of-pocket cost to get like the test for learning disability diagnosis.
Well, it depends. So this is another thing that happened in elementary school. Is my mom, when she first started discussing this about. Or when a teacher told my mom, oh, you should get Colin tested for learning disabilities. And so my mom went back and forth, and my dad, they were like, well, I don't want Colin labeled, and this might have been in first grade. So a few years passed, they get the tutor and stuff, and it's like, oh, well, we can deal with this ourselves. But then what happened? In elementary school, so this was like a few years after, oh, we can handle this ourselves. School starting to get a lot harder, and I'm having these issues, and it's like my parents are coming around to like, oh, well, maybe a diagnosis would be okay. And one thing that my parents started asking about that, or my mom did, and she was told, she was like, okay, well, why don't you, or a counselor actually in the school, had a son who was dealing with some of the similar things, but was a little older, so she was more experienced with it. She pulled my mom aside privately and was like, look, you know, you need to get Colin diagnosed on your own, and then it's a medical condition, and then the school will have to follow the ADA. My parents ended up getting me privately tutored. But one thing though that this counselor told my mom, and we're so thankful she said this, but was like, she's like, look, if you tell anyone I told you this, I'll deny it. And she's like, the reason is because if a public school, at least this was in Missouri, you know, 20 years ago, in Missouri, if a school identifies a student with learning disabilities, then they're on the hook for providing him or her accommodations, which I think is the right thing to do. But the problem with that is when schools aren't very wealthy, they don't have a lot of money, their teachers might be told not to do that. And so then it comes in, and it's like there becomes this larger disparity where it's parents that can get their kids tested that have that extra $1,500, $1,000, whatever, and then the kids who can't. And so my parents were able to. And so then I got that personal diagnosis, and then she used that to get me diagnosed or to get me tested again through the school, because the school had to do their own. So it was just, it's just a waste of time and resources, I think.
Wow.
But yeah, it's way more complicated than it should be.
Yeah.
I think.
So when you were going into high school, at what point did you start to sort of think about what you wanted to do after that, like where you sort of saw yourself going?
So I wanted to be a physical therapist for years, and that was because my freshman year of high school, I had this growth spurt, and some part of my quadriceps weren't developing fast enough. And so then my knee would rub on the joint, like, as I would run. And so my knees hurt when I ran, which, you know, when you're 13, 14, 15, however old you are as a freshman, you know, that's not supposed to happen. So then I went to physical therapy, and they fixed it. And I, most of the things that I do in my life, I do it obsessively. And so it, like, worked really, really well and quickly. And so I was like, oh, there's a problem, and they fixed it. I want to do this. You know, it was one of those things. And then I chose Bradley University as where I went to college, because they had a good physical therapy program. And then in addition to that, it was a small school, and they also had a really, they had a good disability resource office. And I think Kathy recommended Bradley to me, or to my parents, and so.
And where is Bradley?
It's in Peoria, Illinois. So it's like halfway between St. Louis and Chicago.
So you go to, well, we'll get to college. More about high school first. So what did you do in high school? I mean, you said you were running, so you were running competitively, like in track competitions?
Yeah, track and cross country.
And so was that a major part of your identity when you were in high school?
Yeah, I think so, because I always had the people I've been closest with or like over the years generally have been runners, especially when I was in school. I've had friends from all over and from, you know, different aspects of my life, but it was always like cross country attracted a certain group of people, and they usually have a lot of energy and can be wild and stuff, and so then that was always something that was really attractive to that. And so those were the people that I think I was really close with in high school. Other things I did student government for a while, but I always just had a problem with authority and didn't, you know, so that didn't, I didn't want to do that after a while. And stuff. Yeah, so like there was a lot of, I don't know, I worked a lot in college or in high school. Worked at a smoothie shop, and it was the best job I've ever had. It's Planet Smoothie, and so I was able to, so that was like really close to school and stuff, and so it was fun, and it was nice to have some extra like spending money and stuff. So that was super cool. I think I was always involved in something. I always needed something to do after school, and like on the weekends and stuff, so I always wanted to do stuff. I think I played roller hockey for a long time too, so it was just always just whatever. I think my parents were early on were like, okay, this kid needs to burn off some of his energy.
Mm-hmm. Were they the ones who suggested getting a job, or was that your idea?
I think I wanted to. I don't know if they suggested it or not. They might have, but I always wanted to work, and I think it was my sophomore year. I waited tables for a while at this like fancy Greek restaurant. And then I was just okay. I mean, I was a busboy, not a waiter, sorry. And that was just okay. But then it wasn't until this Planet Smoothie job, I was like, oh, work can be fun and awesome. So, I did that for a while, too.
Any really important teachers or classes that you remember from high school?
There were definitely really important teachers. But I have to say, like, I cannot honestly think of specific like classes or teachers that like were like pivotal in like guiding me to do what I'm doing. But I definitely had like the teachers that just like made me want to learn. I had a lot of those, whether it was history teachers. I even had a chemistry teacher who was actually, this is now I think about this, he was a PhD, and he would always say, he was always like, I'm a PhD, I'm a real scientist, not like these other guys. And so we're just like, that's a weird thing to say, like, you know. But I didn't realize that, but yeah, so he has a PhD in chemistry or some specific application of chemistry, and his class was always really interesting. I don't even remember his name. But it was always really interesting. But he definitely was negative about, they're not real scientists. And now I guess, like, being a scientist, I'm like, okay, sure, I get it. But you don't have to say that to teachers. High school, I remember being in college and thinking how high school didn't really prepare me for college, but it was Kathy that prepared me. And I remember specifically thinking that, like learning how to study. I think that was like the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And then also learning how to socialize with a lot of different people. We had a really, it was a big high school, and so I think that was one thing. It was also very diverse too. And so I think that was something that was incredibly fortunate, where it was like, it wasn't weird that, you know, the high school was, and I don't know if it was like 50 or 60% white guys and girls, and then people of color, and whether it was like Indian, black, or Middle Eastern and stuff. And so it was all, it was like really, really nice that like we didn't realize how fortunate we had it that like we went to like a really diverse school. Like it was until college when I went to Bradley University where I was like, oh, wow, it's like all white guys and girls. And I was like, oh, it's really white here. What's going on? But, you know, I guess I added to that issue going there. Yeah, so that's it.
All right, well, let's take a break.
Sorry, I'm going to turn this airplane mode.
All right, so we were talking about high school, and you're sort of thinking about where you were going to go to college. You said that you had this experience with needing physical therapy for your knee, and so that kind of like got it into your head that you wanted to pursue that as a career, and then...
Yeah.
Talking with your tutor, Kathy, you said she was the one who sort of recommended that you look at Bradley College.
Yeah, I think it was her. My mom might have been doing internet research at the time, but regardless, yeah.
So did you look at any other colleges, or was it just Bradley?
I also applied to Mizzou, but I didn't. I only applied to Mizzou and Bradley, and I just assumed I was going to get into Bradley. And so I just applied to Mizzou just cause, but yeah, I guess, I mean, my biggest concern was the GRE, and then that was,
You mean the SAT?
The ACT, that's right, we don't do the GRE, now, the GRE is for college, or for graduate school, yes, the ACT,
okay.
So, I took that, and I got accommodations for that, and my score was very poor. Which is how I score on those type of tests. But something that was actually pretty awesome about that test was in the reading portion of it, I did really bad. But I did good for me, though. And the reason I did well for me is because, you know how they give passages about random things. And so, and then you have to like understand what is meant in those passages, right? And so that's how those like reading comprehensive things work, and that's something that's really difficult for me. One out of the four passages, I think, or the handful of passages that we had to write about or answer questions about, one of them was about the artist Hieronymus Bosch, and I had done a project on him, and I think it was the Garden of Heavenly Delight. I don't know, it was like that triptych one where it's all super weird, right? Hieronymus Bosch, and just really bizarre. And I was just like, oh, this guy's super cool. But it was about him. And so just that obscure artist. And so as soon as I started reading, I felt really good. And so then that, I don't think I did well in the reading section, but I'm pretty sure that probably increased my percentage. You know, like I probably bumped up a grade level. might have increased like a 4 or 5 percentage or 6 or 7 percentage points because I knew some of the answers to some of the obscure questions because of what I read. Mm-hmm. Or at least I think I did. I don't know. So getting that extended time was helpful, but also randomly knowing what they're talking about also was really helpful too.
Were you very like concerned about going into the ACT? Like, was this a
I knew I was gonna do bad.
And take any of those sorts of prep classes?
I didn't take a prep class, but I studied with my tutor, Kathy. And that was definitely something where I was like, oh, I know I'm going to do poor on this. Excuse me. But yeah, I was always really nervous about standardized tests, and even still today, I don't have to take them anymore, but they sound horrible.
Yeah. And in terms of getting into college, like, were you concerned about your scores for that reason?
Yeah, I think I probably got on the low end of what Bradley said was acceptable. Because I remember getting my score and being like, oh, this is above what they said is the minimum. And like, the minimum is, I don't remember what the score was or even what it was out of. I think that maybe 36 or something, and like I like needed like a 20 or I didn't need a very high score. And so it was one of those things where it was like I was just above it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, like had that Hieronymus Bosch question not been on there, that could have affected it. I don't know.
Right. All right, so you decide to go to Bradley, you think you're going for physical therapy. Was there like culture shock at all? I mean, Peoria, Illinois is pretty far from St. Louis.
Yeah, so it's 3 hours away. It was hard. Like, one, when I first went there, I got there early and I walked onto the cross country team. I was never particularly fast in high school. I've always worked really hard, and I went to like the first like cross country meeting, and so I had like an immediate in with like a group of students that I liked, and it was always, I think, because I was the worst person on that team. On the next person's worst day, on my best day, I couldn't touch them. And this was also, it was also Division I cross country. So like, I can still say like, for like 3 years, so I ran for 3 years, I ran Division I cross country, but I was terrible. I was the worst one on the team. And I regularly got the last, last place or like second or third or fourth to last. But like all the people running back there are like, hey, I'm doing this for fun. So it didn't really matter. I had like an immediate in, and I think because I wasn't taking anyone's spot, and once people got over like, oh, Colin's likable and he's also slow, I think that kind of helped out a little bit. So I think that was good. So that helped. When I first got there, I was staying in a single room, too, and I was staying in a single room because I wet the bed, and that's a really good way to destroy someone's self-esteem with enuresis. This really wonderful way to make yourself feel horrible about yourself. So I think my mom might have called the college or like Bradley and was like, "So Colin has this," and it wasn't like all the time, but it was enough to be horrible. You only have to pee yourself a few times to feel horrible. So then I got my single room, and so then I was like, oh, well, now I'll need to really go out of my way to, like, meet people, you know, which is something that I never really had to do. And so then that was kind of difficult. And then also, like, lying to people about how I got a single room as a freshman. And I was like, oh, yeah, I had an elaborate lie. But it was because I beat my bed. So that was something that was a little difficult, but I think in cross country, the group of guys that I ran with were really close right away. So then that was like really, really helpful. And then as I got more into biology, you know, then I had a core group of biology friends, and then even the friends in my first dorm, you know. So then it was like I had a handful of friends in like different areas where kind of like float around. So that helped out with the culture shock. I think so.
And what about the, like, academic? Was there an academic shock? You said you felt pretty prepared because of your tutor.
I felt prepared because of my tutor. And, like, this is when I was going through my, like, angsty, I'm 18, I know everything. And so then I was like, oh, high school was pointless. And it was one of those things. And I was like that for more years than I like to admit. And so I felt prepared. And another thing that I did, though, was like in college, I was like, oh, this is the first time I can prove to myself that the reason that I'm getting a good grade isn't because my parents, or isn't because of my older teachers liking my older brother, or people liking my sister, or people liking the Diedrichs, you know? And so then a lot of it was like, oh, well, every time I did something well, you know, I would be like, oh, well, there's always an asterisk by it that I always felt. And so then that was like, oh, well, now I can finally do it myself. And then I was very obsessive over it. I started taking Ritalin or Adderall or what the summer before college. And so that was, I mean, prescribed. And that was something that was really interesting because, like, I never read a book on my own prior to that. And I was actually able to read a book. And so that was like, I was like, oh, I get it. It's like a movie for my head. You know, I remember literally thinking that, right? And that's a dumb thing to think, but that's what books are, right? And the book, the first book I read like that I chose to read, I think was Kurt Vonnegut. It was like Ice Nine, I think, or Catch 22. It was one of those books. And it was just one of those weird, silly books. I was like, oh, this will be perfect. And so I think that that medication, which I never was on, I think that helped out a lot. And then it got to the point, though, where, because like as obsessive as I can get about things, and I still do, I have like my primary goal was like, okay, I need to get good grades, and I also need to run. And like those two things like dictated my life. And I studied probably maybe my freshman year, and I was like, you know, those medications, you titrate. And so you don't know exactly what level is going to work effectively. I started off on a dose that was too high, or it was too low, and then because I was running cross country, I talked to my doctor, and I was like, look, you know, we're running 60, 70 miles a week, you know, I don't have enough, you know, in me to, like, study later. And so we, like, jumped up to, like, the highest dose. And I loved it. It made me feel really good, because I was also feeling kind of high when I was in it. And I could study 12, 13, 14, 15 hours a day, super easy. And like, people aren't supposed to do that.
No.
Yeah, no. And so then, so that was that first semester, and then I started getting worried about it, because I was like, my heart rate's going really fast, but I can read things. And so I was like debating, like, what's worth, is my heart more important or grades? And so then, towards the end of that semester, I went to my doctor, and I was like, my biggest issue is that I like this too much. And so we reduced the low, or the titrated it down, and then I was studying, you know, not those like 12 hours a day, but probably close to like 8, 9, 10 hours a day, and this is every day. And it was I was like the student that would, I'd wake up early, I'd study for a few hours in the cafeteria, go to class, study in between classes, go to cross country practice for two, three hours, and then study. I was just studying. I just was able to study, and I just really wanted to learn. And I think it was like the first time in my life I ever felt smart, because like people would tell me I was smart with things, and other people would tell me I was stupid with certain things. And so it was this time I was like, oh, I'm actually doing well in my classes, and this is because of the hard work I'm putting in. But I mean, I was studying 40, 50 hours for a specific test. You know, and I used to have a rule where I was like, if I don't know it the day before, then I'm not going to learn it, you know, and which is, young Colin was so stupid. It's like, you need to study, you study right before things. But it was just very, because I was always like studying and always, I was just always very obsessive of that. And it wasn't until my first biology class that I like fell in love with biology, and I got the highest grade in my biology class, the first test I ever took in college. And like, I never got the highest grade on tests. And I think I got like a 96%. And I remember this is because the professor wrote the highest grade on the class and then said like, this is what the average is. This is what the standard deviation is. And I was like, oh my God, I remember hiding it, being really embarrassed and not telling people. I was like, oh my God, that 96 was me, or whatever it was. And just because I love the subject. But in order to get that 96%, I sat up close, and I sat in the front row, or front two rows. I had a tape recorder. We get out, we get our PowerPoints, right? And so this was in 2002? Yeah, 2002, I think. So it was all like PowerPoint based. Print out the PowerPoints, and then I would write the time on the recorder for every slide. And so it's like, oh, the first one starts at zero. The second one starts at like, is like 2 minutes. And I would write my notes down. Then I would go to the library or go to my dorm, and I would write, re-listen to the lecture, which would take about twice as long, write out a detailed notes. I would highlight those notes and type those notes up. Then I would go through the book, and I would highlight the books, highlight the chapters that we were supposed to read, type those notes up, highlight those. Then I have two sets of typed notes. Then I would combine them, and then I would make flashcards from the typed note. Oh yeah, it was ridiculous. But it was just because I like really enjoyed learning.
That's amazing.
And so, but it was also one of those things where like, it's just because I had to. Like I had to, like I learned early on that I had to study more than the average person. And so then I think that like that 96%, I remember thinking like, oh, I think I studied 40 or 50 hours for this test over the course of a few weeks or a month, I don't know. And I remember two things specifically. One was I remember that an acquaintance of mine was complaining to me that I didn't study the day before. Remember my stupid rule, don't study the day before. He's like, I studied all night for this test, and you got an A on it, and I got a C or a B or something. And I was like, well, yeah, but like I studied for like 40 or 50 hours. Like, I studied for this class like at least 4 days a week for the last 5 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever it was. I was like, I was studying almost every day. And so realizing like, oh, I guess there's, I was like, I don't like this jealousy thing. This is weird. So then I like didn't want to talk about grades with people. But another thing, though, is I remember getting that 96 and being like, oh, I wonder how many hours the next person studied. And so then I had to come to the realization that how much other people study doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter to me. And so it's, I think that's something that a lot of people with learning disabilities, you're constantly comparing yourself to other people. And like, I was incredibly happy. My parents were worried, or my mom mostly was worried that I was studying too much, and I would like run and study, but when I would run, I was hanging out with my friends and also working out. But then I'd also study a lot because I liked it, you know? And so my balance was definitely, was off, you know, and I studied most Friday nights and stuff. And so when I went out with my like cross country buddies who were, they got decent grades, but when I went out, it was like a big deal. I was like, oh, Colin's going out. Oh, this is great, you know? Because I just studied and studied. And I just felt like I got to the point where I was doing well, but I was never really satisfied with my grades. I have a problem with like being complacent. And so it's like, oh, well, if I'm getting, I got this good grade, okay, well, that was in the past. When's the next test? And so it doesn't matter anymore. And it's something that I still struggle with now, where it's like, oh, you get this paper out. Well, that's great, but that's in the past. What's the next step? And it's hard, because it's I'm constantly moving the goal like back. And it's something I even talk to my wife about a lot. And it's just like, well, why aren't you just happy with the things that you're doing? And I'm like, I am happy, but it's not enough, you know, and I need the next thing. And I'm fortunate enough where like I'm going through like having the horrible self-esteem of someone who wets the bed at summer camp to now where it's like, look, I know the things I'm bad at and know the things that I'm good at, to like now where it's like, look, yeah, so I said that I wanted this thing and this thing came, but I was like, I don't want to settle for that. I want this next thing. And so everything keeps getting pushed back, you know, and it works for me. But I think I learned that in college, because it was like, oh, I got this 96, but oh my God, now I need to get the next highest grade in the class again. And I don't think I ever got the highest grade again. But I did well, and I think I got an A in that class. But it was... Yeah, so then that class made me feel really like biology, and I was thinking, oh, well, maybe I want to be a clinician. And so then there was a class sophomore year that was a weed-out class for the pre-med students and then the cell and molecular biology students, so the students with getting the biology degrees. And they were like, oh, my God, this class is so hard, and people kept complaining about it, and I was like, all right, I'll take it. And I literally took it because people were saying it was hard. And I was like, I'll take that challenge. And it wasn't necessarily like I want to get into research. It was a research-based course. But it was literally like, oh, people think this is a really hard class. And so I was like, all right, sign me up. I'll do it. And I'm really glad I did. And so then that was my sophomore year when I changed, or I added a major or something. And then I think I was pre-med for a little bit, maybe not, and then changed it strictly to a research-based, getting a degree in cell and molecular biology and wanting to go to grad school.
Can I ask a question? Previously, you mentioned being starting medication in college. Is there a reason that you weren't on medication during high school or previously?
Yeah, you know, I think it was a lack of knowledge, honestly, about what the treatments are. I think also I probably didn't want to take anything, and I was able to get decent grades without it, and so then I didn't think that it was necessary. It wasn't until I took two classes at a community college in St. Louis before my freshman year of college, and I took them so I could lessen the load. So if I took, you know, 6 credits, then it was 3 hours less each semester, you know, and that was some advice that one of our good friends, family friends, told us. And so then I took those classes, and I also started taking the Ritalin, I think it was Ritalin at that time. And I would take it, you know, in the morning and in the afternoon. And so then that was like, oh, well, college is going to be so much harder than that. This is why I need to take the medication and stuff. And I think actually I was really fortunate because, like, the work ethic that I developed over the years, you know, with the help of Kathy, with the help of my parents and family and friends and everybody, because I can't, like, take credit for any of the things that I do. But, like, with, like, all that, like, that was developed and then without medication. So then when I had the medication too, and that's why I think that, like, I was able just to really study and just really, like, non-stop studying, but it never bothered me. Like, I always enjoyed studying and I always enjoyed learning, and I had a hard time understanding when people wouldn't, or when people would study just a few days before a test, and I was like, well why would you wait? Like, why wouldn't you read that chapter like a week ago when you were supposed to? It didn't like even occur to me, you know. So that was it.
Was there anything in particular about that biology class that you took that made you fall in love with it? Or do you think it was because you were able to devote so much, like, attention and time to it that you fell in love with it through the work? Like, I'm just interested in,
yeah,
in, like, what it was that drew you into this, like, career path, because going into, like, research science is not something that, you know, most people do.
So I think it's a few things. One is, I forget the degree that I was, the degree I went for was pre-physical therapy degree, whatever. And I think when I first went there, the one pre-physical therapy class that I was taking, like, for your first semester, because mostly it's electives, was this health course that I hated. And I hated it because I worked really hard on it, and I could tell that when I worked for hours on, like, an essay or something, I'm like, oh, this is about health and health policy or whatever it was. I can't totally remember. And I remember the professor just giving, like, oh, check, turned it in, like, didn't read it. And I could tell that she didn't read it. You know, it was just, like, the random, like, dot, dot, dot on it. And so then it put a really bad taste in my mouth, and I was like, if you're a teacher and you're and you are administering a test, or if you have an assignment, he should read it, especially if I'm working hard on it. And so then that sullied my experience a little bit, I think. But then, so while that was happening, I was taking the biology class and I was doing well. It's just general biology. But, like, it's, maybe it wasn't organismal biology, but it's just, I don't know, what I find so fascinating about biology, and this is what was initially started, I think, you know, this career path, is that biology basically explains what is going on inside a person. And what is going on, like why things are the way that they are, just generally. And it's not like physics, because there's a lot of things that you can't see and we don't totally understand, and all these like weird theories and stuff. And there's still all those theories. But also, like, you know, our body is made up of a lot of cells and we don't understand a lot of things. As we dove more into this is what cells do, and it's like, oh, well, how do cells know to do this? And it's like, oh, well, this is what a phenotype is. This is what a genotype is. A genotype, right? The random nucleotides for in DNA or RNA. And then the phenotype is like what it actually expresses. And so it's like, oh, well, then there's this connection here, but there's also a disconnect because there's environment that helps. Helps people, or like changes how people are, what those phenotypes are, and there's genetics that are based on this. And so it was just fascinating. And then there were like a lot of questions that were asked that weren't totally understood, that we didn't know. And this is like one of the first times that I realized that it's okay to not know something, you know. And as I, the more that I've learned over the years, and even in my area of research, and you know, like the more you know, the more you know you don't know, you know. And so it's in biology, I feel like I started to get the first taste of that. And the professor, he was a geneticist, and so he spent a lot of time talking about genes, and it was just really cool. And I remember even learning about how like DNA, how replication happens, and how DNA unwinds, and how there's proteins that do all these very specific things. And it was just such a cool representation of how the body works and how everything needs to work appropriately in order for the whole organism to develop appropriately and be normal, or just like grow up, and when something bad happens you can develop cancer, you know. And so it's like, oh, well, you develop cancer because of a mistake in a genome, you know, in a gene, and like one mistake can like override these protections that these enzymes have. And so then a lot of that just general stuff, it was more in the organism side that I was just fascinated with. I also was taking a psychology class, and I loved that because it was just about people and like how people think. And so I think that was why those two classes, when I was like, oh, maybe I'd want to go be a clinician. And then, so I think that I was studying so much, but I had these two classes that I really liked, the biology one mostly, and just like how things were, how people work and stuff was just really cool. And it was easy studying that much for it, you know.
And so at what point did you decide, okay, I'm gonna set my sights on like a research career?
That would have been after, so I took organismal biology, which was my sophomore year, and that was that weed out college course. And that was something, what was it? So that was, you would design experiments, we'd have a project that was like, okay, so what percentage of alcohol makes beets, like cut up beets, change color the most? You know, it's like, oh, it's a higher alcohol content. It's like one of those studies. But you had to like write out a report to do that. Or like, how does water diffuse when you put it in a bag and there's a bunch of pores in this bag that are really small, but it's like salt water versus non, you know, like fresh water and stuff. Okay, so water, osmolarity works for is like water travels to the most concentrated place, right? And so there's like a lot of these like really simple, really simple but delicate and just interesting, or not even interesting questions, but you could answer those questions and say like, okay, so wait, so why did this group over here get this percentage of alcohol in changing the beets color, and why did we not? And it's like, oh, well, you know, we cut our beets in different, with different sizes or something. And then we will learn about like the cross-sectional area. We learn about pores and how water transfers within within an organism and stuff. And so there was always like, there was a clear application for all the experiments that we were doing. And so that class I studied a lot for, and I studied, was using the same study techniques, but it was more, I was studying more for that class than anything else because I just liked it so much. And I did real well in that class, and one of the professors that was running that class, his name was Eric Stabenow, he had an animal physiology lab, and I asked if I could join it. So it was the second semester of my sophomore year, and he had a few projects that were ongoing at that time, and the project that I joined was looking at, I think at least my senior year project, I think I looked at changes in mitochondrial oxygen consumption within the brains of Fisher rats that were given cocaine hydrochloric acid in a hypoxic environment. So let me break this down for you about how stupid this project was. But, or not stupid, how there were just so many variables about this project. But it was a great research experience. It was a research experiment where we were working with animals, we were giving them, my boss bought cocaine, HCL, from like Fisher, and it was always like locked key and stuff. But we would like measure it out, give it to these animals, and then measure their mitochondrial oxygen consumption after we homogenized their brains. So the rats were not very happy with us. That was one thing that was always really hard, is like the animal research aspect of it. But I always thought, though, that like, oh, well, this is to help me answer a question. But, you know, what question do we answer? Nothing really. But what it did was it allowed us to, allowed me to really fall in love with science and really wanted to go into research. And so then I think it was that year where I was like, oh, well, I really want to, I want to research HIV. And then I had this goal of doing HIV research in sub-Saharan Africa, because I was like, I'd like to do HIV research, whatever that is, but in sub-Saharan Africa. And I think that was like 2004, I think, or 2003, when I started thinking this. And I was writing all my goals down at that time, too. Then it really just solidified everything that I wanted to do. And so then I started spending more and more time in this research lab over the next few years. And we were working on these projects. I became good friends with a handful of students that were in the lab and also in a lot of these like biology classes. And there was a lot of overlap between cross-country runners and biology too. It's mostly the women cross-country runners though. And so then it was like, there was a lot of people that I really liked in it, and I loved biology. I started reading more about HIV, and like I picked up the book, what was it? I think it was called Invisible People. And like, I don't buy books very much, and it was just about how the U.S. government had a really good chance to really dampen the HIV epidemic, or this is right when it was like becoming known in like the early 80s, and how because the majority of transmission cases, especially early on, were through sex, and it was really hard to even like talk about that with like a more conservative government, and so like how it was just kind of like, oh well, let's not deal with this. And so then it was one thing where I was like, oh, but they could have made policies that might have been able to help give like aid and stuff to certain areas. And so then that was one thing where I was like, it's my first like taste of, or first like inkling of like, oh, well, what policy the government does, like that can actually affect people, and not even just like, it can affect people that aren't even Americans, you know, and stuff. And it's like, how, you know, what can you do to help? And so then that's when I like started just like really obsessing over it and being like, all right, well, I want to be this HIV researcher. I want to do something great, you know, which that has changed. But it was nice. It was definitely really motivating, at least going through college.
So was there a professor working on HIV stuff at Bradley?
Not at Bradley, no. I just really wanted to. And when I started applying to colleges or to graduate schools, which was a horrible experience, I started looking at what they were doing, or which colleges have good HIV programs. Mm-hmm. And that was, I applied to Pitt, like, I wasn't planning on applying to Pitt, but I applied to 7 schools, and then it was like the one day I just was randomly looking up HIV researchers, and there were a lot at Pitt. And I was like, oh, I guess I could apply, and I sent in the $50 application fee or whatever it was, and applied. But it was one of those like, well, I'm definitely getting into these other schools. And I got rejected from every other school. It was horrible. It was horrible. And like, I was just thankful that I did apply to Pitt.
Well, I don't, so have you, when you were in college, and you're sort of getting your footing in the biology world, and thinking about going into research, was there ever a person or a moment when you thought, like, this is, or someone said, you know, maybe you should think twice about going down this path with, like,
oh yeah, totally,
your you know, with your learning disabilities or whatever,
that yeah,
you felt
yeah.
like, you know.
Oh yeah, totally. Okay. So I was really fortunate that I was surrounded by a lot of like really positive people, and people that didn't care that I had learning disabilities, and that's how I approach it. Like, I want to be like, oh well, the reason I do this poorly is because of learning disability, and I want someone's response to be, oh okay. Like, I don't care. Like, you will read well, fine. That literally has nothing to do with me. Like, that's the reaction I prefer. I think for years I was trying to overcompensate. And so the reason that I was like studying so much is and like trying to get like the best grade in the class, which I did a handful of times, was to prove to everybody else that I could do it, and to prove, but mostly to prove to myself, where like it wasn't good enough. Even in that organismal biology class, that the class that made me fall in love with research, it wasn't good enough just to get an A in the class, which is really hard to get an A in. But it was like one of those like, oh well, I want to get the best grade in this class, and like studying, and I don't remember, but I remember getting a high A in it. And but it was because like that class I studied probably 2 times as much as I was studying for my biology class, and so I was doing, you know, it was like nonstop. But it was just because I feel like imposter complex, and so a lot of it was just internal, where it was like, oh well, they're gonna figure out that you don't deserve to be here, or that you're really stupid, and so if I get a bad grade, then they're gonna say I'm stupid, and so that was a really big driving force. And so I think that like the biggest critic was myself. In college, I was pretty fortunate. Nothing rings a bell with like, oh well, why would you do this? Beyond like random conversations with people, like whether it's people in my family or people like friends, they'd be like, oh wait, science has a lot of reading. Why would you want to do that? It was mostly like that. I'm like, mm-hmm. That is a logical question. Mm-hmm. You're bad at reading, and then why would you want to do a career or follow a career that requires you to read a lot? It wasn't until, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, it wasn't until graduate school, and we'll talk a lot more about this in detail, I think, but that I failed an oral comprehensive exam. And that is, you write a thesis proposal your second year of grad school, so this would have been 2007, and then that gets, it's like the research you want to do over your next like 4 years of school or 5 years of school. Then that gets passed or failed, and then you orally defend that like a few weeks or a month after. And what happened, I took my oral defense and I failed it. And we can talk more about why I failed it later. But I failed it, and it was horrible. Because if you fail it twice, you get kicked out of school. Mm. You get a terminal master's, which is just the most arrogant. That's like the most arrogant thing a PhD program could do. It's like, oh, we'll just give you a master's, which is not very good. That's not very cool. Like, master's still important. So I failed that, and I deserved to fail. It wasn't like I was treated poorly. And I went to the head of disability resources here, and she's not here anymore, so I feel more comfortable saying this, at Pitt. And one thing she said to me was, she was like, oh, well, you failed this. She was like, okay, well, would you think about like going into business or something? And it was something like that. And I was like, what? So I was like, like what? And I was like, no. And I was taken back by it, but like you get used to it, I think, when you have learning disabilities, people saying stuff like that. And I was like, no. I was like, no, I don't want to go. If I wanted to go into business, I would have gone into business school. And she was like, oh, okay. And I was like, look, I want to do this. And so to her credit, she literally suggested it, even though I wasn't pleased with her suggesting it. And then immediately when I was like, no, I didn't go to business school, I want to do this. And she's like, oh, okay. And so then we worked on a plan to help like me like pass that comps. But so that's something that happened to me, and then happened to one of my other friends who had learning disabilities. This is a few years later when she was diagnosed here. And the same thing happened. She didn't fail her comps, but she got diagnosed and went to this head person, and the head person was like, oh, are you sure you want to do this? Which I guess, you know, if you're too sensitive to answer like, yes, I'm sure I want to do this, then maybe I am a liberal snowflake. But like, look, like it's, but it was one of those things where it's like, we deal with this stuff so much, like just support. And to be fair, Pitt's been great about supporting and doing that. But so there were those like handful of times that happened. There were times too in interviews and stuff, because I did really bad on my GRE. And I think it was in the bottom 30 percentile in reading and 40% or 60 percentile in math, I think. But I'm sure I got the lowest matriculating student GRE at Pitt. And something that was happening here was, when I was interviewing at schools, I interviewed here and I interviewed at University of Chicago. My learning disabilities, like I was like, oh, I'm just going to be upfront about it. And then I realized that probably wasn't the right thing to do, just because of like the stigmas associated with it. And I ended up getting rejected from the University of Chicago, and a part of me was like, oh, well, so you go back and you like check all, you know, you're like, oh, well, wait, why did I get rejected? You know, the interviews went so well and did all this. And I was like, oh yeah, I kept talking about my learning disabilities. And so then you start questioning things, whether that had anything to do with it or not. So then I like kind of like regressed and was like, oh, I'm not going to talk to people about my learning disabilities when I go to grad school. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so just beyond those like few people and beyond the director of special services or whatever at in my high school, middle school, there haven't been a ton of people that have been very negative to me, or I feel like I've been able to like surround myself with people that have been pretty positive with it. And I think in like the scientific community, it helps out, because it's it doesn't matter as much, where it's like, oh, you have this? Okay. Like, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
But I realized that like that's kind of a unique experience.
Were there any professors in your undergraduate experience who were particularly like supportive, or who encouraged you to pursue research?
Yeah. And so this Eric Stabenow, He was the professor that I did my research with, and he was really supportive. And he was one of those professors that we would just like joke around with, and we isn't like, there's like a few of us that joined his lab and stuff. And it was, I don't know, the first time that like I felt friendly with a professor. And he was great and like very, very knowledgeable. We were doing these projects, and you know, he was able to, you know, have us like ask a specific question, and he was able to, you know, encourage us and stuff, and like expected a lot from us. Was a pretty tough teacher, but that was really helpful. There was another professor, Al McCrell. He was like the cell and molecular biology teacher, and one thing that he did in his classes, which was great, was he would put in up-to-date literature for like the topics that we would discuss. And it was like the amount of detail that was put into each of these lectures was way more than necessary. But it was really interesting though, because I remember other professors being like, I don't know why Al does this. But like to us, it was like, yeah, it doesn't matter that like the subunit of helicase, it's an enzyme that like snips DNA, is that he found research that showed that this enzyme is different than we thought. But it was like he was showing us how science changes nonstop and how we keep adding to it. And like textbooks are wonderful. People give textbooks a bad rap, but they're great. They give you a great foundation. But textbooks teach things as they should, as like, this is how this is, this is how this is. But as you get more, as you dive more in more depth of like a specific topic, you learn that nothing is one or zero. There's so much stuff in between. And so that was really cool with him. I also had one of my favorite classes I ever took, and this is like to date, was, God, it was Central American history, I think. And it was the first time, like this is my like moment of like being a student and being like, did my teachers in high school lie to me? It was one of those moments where I was like, I just had no idea. And this professor was this older lady. She was super tough, like really just, she looked like, was like one of those like standard, like, who had a mean teacher? And like, you like the, a mean teacher, there's like an older lady, like, just very skinny. Like, I'm sure she like wanted to walk around with like a ruler or something. And she, I don't think she was mean. But that was just like the no BS. And I remember taking that class and thinking, and being like, wait a minute, why would the U.S. government support this dictator in this country? I was like, that doesn't make sense, because we want to spread democracy, lady. And she was just like, nope. This, and it was really interesting. And it was just about like, I remember some train in Honduras that the U.S. government was like, oh, we need to fund this certain thing, and how, oh, this other person trying to control this other, the person that controls the one railroad, and whether it's Honduras or some other Central American country, and it was like how, like, oh, well, they need to back this other dictator to actually get this thing, and how it was like there was like a lot of stuff that was happening behind the scenes that we just never learned. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was like really, really cool. I studied really hard for that class, and I got a B, and I am incredibly proud of that B. And it was all essay tests, and I was like, I don't know if I can get an A in this class, which was like, I don't know, I definitely didn't get A's in all my classes, but I definitely was like, oh, this is a Central American history class, this is gonna be super easy, and it wasn't, but I loved it because I definitely learned a lot. And I think like those, you know, with her being like, oh, yes, you can't really believe everything that you hear. You need to like dive in to say, to learn more about, don't take facts at their face value. And then with Eric Stabenow, with doing actual research, with Al McCrell, who was able to give us up-to-date information that was completely unnecessary, but it was like, oh, well, this subunit of this protein is not what people say it says in the book. Like, that was kind of cool. And so I feel like with a lot of these professors, and then there's like a handful of other ones that I just thought were really, that were just really great, they kind of shaped, yeah, my career, definitely.
Were all of your professors aware that you have a learning disability?
Yeah, yeah. And so one thing that was actually really cool about Bradley and is that Bradley forced, and I use forced as like a good term, not as a, which normally is, but it forced the students with learning disabilities to give, you meet with a representative from the disability office, you get a letter that says, I have learning disabilities and these are my accommodations. And they forced you to give that letter to the professor of your classes. And this is important because the most important thing that people with learning disabilities, and I think disabilities in general, is that you need to learn how to self-advocate. And so you need to say, look, like, this is something that I'm good at, this is something that I can do, this is something that I can't do. And what that does is that starts a dialogue. And I remember this the employee there, and I can't remember who it was, but she specifically said, like, she's like, we require our students to talk to the professors and stuff, and so this opens that dialogue, so it won't be hard when you do it the next time. And all of the professors, they all had, and like to date, they still do, they all have a sentence saying like, you know, following ADA requirements, you know, if anyone has any disabilities, please talk to me. And so I felt like people were really open. The professors were always very open about learning disabilities, and I was always very open to talk to them. And so, but that was another thing where I was like, oh, I'm giving you this, and I have learning disabilities, and I was like, oh, I bet you think I'm stupid, so now I need to get a good grade in this class. And so there was a lot of stuff like that that really like forced me to like study more. I mean, it was just, I liked learning, but also I didn't want people to think I was stupid, and that was like very important to me.
So you mentioned that Bradley College was sort of known for having good disability resources.
Yeah, yeah.
So were there other students around that also had disabilities that you...
There were. I prefer to study by myself, and so I don't think I got close to anyone with learning disabilities there. Something that was interesting with Bradley is that Bradley gave, and this is at the time, so Bradley University, they gave 2 hours of free tutoring to all their students. And so it was like for, you know, tutoring in the learning center or whatever it was. And if you were an athlete there, you got free, unlimited tutoring, okay? And so my freshman year there, so this is going from me, I've been going to tutors from like first grade to third grade, then the same tutor from third grade to 12th grade, right? So I'm a professional tutor student. And I remember I was taking calculus, which I was horrible at. I went to a tutor 4 hours a week for that. And then there was one other class. God, what was it? I don't think it was biology. Maybe it was literature. There were two classes. It was calculus, and then I don't know if I got tutored for biology, but I can't remember the other class. But these two classes, I was studying for 6 hours a week with a specific tutor, because like math just does not, like I will not figure out what the slope of this line is or anything beyond the slope, or like it just did not come naturally, and like I literally need someone to like walk me through every step. And so I was seeing this tutor or these tutors, and privately or whatever, because the school was paying for it, and they're paying $7 an hour, $8 an hour, whatever it was. And so the athletic director sent a nasty email to me and CC'd my coach and said, Colin, why are you going to 6 hours of tutoring a week? There is a group math tutor at one of the times that you went. You should be going to the group tutor. And they were like, you're choosing up too much. You're taking advantage of the system. And so then I was like, what? I was like, this is ridiculous. And also like, I emailed my coach. And I was like, Dave, this is ridiculous. Like, we get free tutoring, and they're telling me that I can't take free tutoring. And I was like, this is not. And he's like, you just deal with it. He's like, it's fine. This is what's whatever you want to do. And so then I told the athletic director, and this is self-advocacy. Like, I don't want to go. I was like, look, I'm an athlete. I'm a bad athlete, but I still am an athlete. And I was like, Bradley offers this free tutoring, I'm going to continue taking it. And so then, like, he couldn't stop me. Like, what, they don't want to spend, like, they're literally spending 4 hours worth, because 2 hours is covered by Bradley, so 4 hours worth, so like 20 some odd, 80 or 28 bucks a week for me. And in that calculus class, I went from a C to an A in the class, like an A minus, I think. And it was only because of these tutors and stuff, and like, it was really, like, it was hard, and I went to office hours with the professor, and like I was like doing everything right, but it's like there's always situations like that where especially where people think like, oh well, if you're not failing, if you're not doing something poorly, then you don't need help. And it's like, well, that shouldn't be the standard. Like, maybe the help is why I'm not doing poorly. Mm. You know, and I think that there's a lot of that stuff that goes on with people with disabilities, you know. Mm.
Did the athletic director know that you had learning disabilities?
I don't, probably not. Because it's not, it's definitely not public. I might have said it. I've gotten way more comfortable talking about my learning disabilities now than I was then. Mm. I was open about it, like to the point where I would screw something up and I'd be like, learning disabilities. And my friends would be like, Colin, shut up. Like, that is not it. And so I'd be like, all right. But just, that was just as a joke. But yeah, I don't know. And I don't know if I mentioned it. I might have when I was, because this is when I was in my like angsty phase. I might have been like, I deserve this bills and I get this and I deserve this. I pay your salary. No, I don't think I ever said that. But, yeah, but it was nice that my coach was fine with me taking more time. And also I felt like because I was getting good grades, that helped me out with being on the team because I raised the overall GPA of the team some. And so, anyway, yeah.
Do you have any follow-up questions? Okay, I think I'm going to call it a day then.
Okay.
I'm Jessica Martucci. I'm here for part two of our interview with Colin Diedrich, and it's June 22nd, 2017. Colin, when we were talking the other day, we were talking about some of your experiences preparing to go into graduate school. I think, in fact, actually, you had talked about your experience not passing your first oral exams, actually, now that I'm thinking about
it.
I think that's where we left off. So you told a story about going to, like, the student learning services at that point. Okay, so we'll pick up there.
Okay.
So what happened after you didn't pass your comps the first time? You went to learning services.
Yeah, well, I think it's I think it's important to say that, like, in, I don't know if, like, last time I described, like, exactly what the comprehensive exam is and how and
I
how
think
it works.
You did, yeah.
Okay.
If you want to go into
well,
that.
Yeah, just to kind of just like paint this the scene. So the way the comprehensive exams work at the University of Pittsburgh in the specific program that I was in, and it's very similar in like a lot of PhD programs in the States, but there is a two-part exam, and at Pitt it takes place at the end of your second year, during your second year. And essentially it is in the two parts, and the first part is a thesis proposal. And so you basically write a thesis proposal that basically describes the experiments that you think you're going to do over your career as a PhD student. And you write that in the form of, essentially it's a form of like an NIH grant, but it's like a truncated version and obviously like not held to the same standard. But still very difficult, and like, you know, there is a ton of writing that happens. You're not allowed to talk to your PI, so that's the, your primary investigator, or the boss of the lab. And you're not allowed to talk to any faculty members about it, but you are allowed to talk to other graduate students and postdocs, and so they're the ones that really help you out with writing it. And then you start looking at old grants and their old theses, and so then you try to like put together, you know, a proposal that works. And so I wrote it, and it was really, really difficult for me. And there was one graduate student that was actually really, really helpful. It surprised me because, like, you know, we weren't close, like, in the lab. Like, we're friendly, it was fine. But she was just incredibly helpful and would always was a really good writer and always gave me, like, really, really helpful comments and stuff in my proposal. And I think that's really important, especially when you have learning disabilities, to find someone, hopefully you can, that can be really that can go out of their way and doesn't mind, and they don't mind actually helping you. And so anyway, so through the help with this graduate student and then these other people in the lab, I wrote the proposal and submitted that, and you submit it to a committee of three people, and they're PIs of different labs, and they have some knowledge of the area that you're writing in. And that written proposal passed, and so that was really exciting. And then after it passes, you basically have like between a week and a month to prepare for your oral exam. And the oral exam essentially is a defense of the thesis. And it is, I don't actually remember how long it is, but it might be 3 hours of time or 2 hours of time. where basically you stand, you're basically in a room like this, and there's a blackboard or whiteboard, and you answer questions that they have about the thesis. And they can range from anything about like just general knowledge of the topic. So my topic was HIV-TB co-infection. And so it could be like, how does HIV infect a cell? To what drugs are used in TB? To how many people are infected? To what experiment are you doing? And why are you doing this? And so it's incredibly broad. In that first defense, I just completely bombed it. Like I failed it, and like I deserved to fail it. I was obsessed with learning the names of the authors in papers, because I think that I was always impressed with the people in my lab that could say, oh, the Reynolds paper, oh, the Schmidt paper, oh, the, you know, all they could list off all of these papers, and they knew the exact experiments and stuff. So I like really tried hard to learn all those like minute details of the literature, which is just something that's very difficult for me. And I also studied parts of HIV literature and TB literature that had nothing to do with my research, because I was like, oh, well, they might ask me mechanistic questions on how a protein enters TB, which has nothing to do with my research. And I remember taking notes on this. And anyway, I studied completely wrong, and it showed. And it was a horrible, horrible experience. And after I failed, I ended up talking to the head of the committee, and he was actually really nice about it. And one thing that he told me that still like sticks with me today is he was like, Colin, like when you're describing a paper, and you know all these details of the paper, you're describing the experiments that they did, which are, those things are easy for me to remember, or are easier for me to remember. You're then saying, oh, and you're like stumbling and stuttering, trying to figure out like who the author was. And he's like, the author doesn't matter. But he's like, as soon as you do that, it makes us think that you actually don't know what's in the paper. And I was like, oh, but I do know. Like, and you know, I could draw the figures. And he's like, well, he's like, this is just how it looks. And so I think that was like really like eye opening. And so I met with him, and other things that like came up in that meeting were like, I tried to answer questions really quickly, because I thought like dead space was bad. That specifically is something that's really hard for me to do. Like, I need some more time to process this. And so after meeting with this professor, I decided, I was like, okay, well, I think I need to go to the learning or the Disability Resource Center and talk to them about it and see if there's other techniques that I could use or implement, and see if other people have had similar experiences. And so I made an appointment with the Disability Resource Office, and I met with the director at the time, and she gave me a bunch of different, you know, a bunch of like good advice. One thing though that like took me back, I was taken back a little bit, was at some point in our dialogue about, you know, what happened during this test, she said something like, oh, well, you know, wow, there is a lot of reading being a scientist. Would you rather go into business? And I was like, and I was taken back. I was like, one, rude. but to her credit, as soon as I was like, well, no, if I wanted to go into business, I would have gone to business school. I was like, I want to be a scientist. And to her credit, she said, she immediately was like, okay, fine, then let's figure out what to do. But I think it's important to note that like even people who are really helpful to you, sometimes they can say things and that you can take either way. You can take like, oh, you don't think I can do it, or you can take, which I think the way that she meant it was like, oh, well, this is gonna be a lot of work. Are you prepared to do it? You know, and I was like, of course I am. And so, but it's easy when you're on the cusp of, when you have learning disabilities and you're on the cusp of feeling good or feeling horrible about yourself, it's really easy to get knocked in either direction. Yeah. And that's something that I think happens a lot. And anyway, so she helped me. She like just talked this over and told me, she said, okay, well, why don't you meet with all the professors and get their advice on like what you can do better, which I think is really, which is, of course, that, you know, that's always a really good idea. And then she's like, you don't have to answer questions immediately because of my processing issues, you know. And she also said, in order to like give yourself an extra time, you know, extra time when you're answering questions, like take a breath or stand up there with a piece of paper, and then when they ask a question, write it down and say something, you know, like write down like, oh, okay, like write just like a few key points and then cover it to help you answer your questions. That'll give you time to collect your thoughts. And so anyway, so I ended up you know, taking all of that to heart, and there was about a month's period of time after I failed my comps where I just was just really sad and miserable. It was pretty horrible. And I didn't think that I was going, I definitely questioned whether I should actually be in graduate school. I questioned like whether I was going to pass it. And I even thought, had those like fleeting feelings of, oh, well, if I don't try, then at least I'll get kicked out. And I'll be like, oh, well, I didn't try, so like maybe I could have. You know, you try to like justify your bad feelings. But then I started to get really like pissed off at myself for feeling so bad about myself. I was like, after like a month, I think it was about a month, I was like, okay, well, if they're going to kick me out, then they're going to kick me out of school, like, with me, like, kicking and screaming. And, like, I would rather fail out trying as hard as I can, because I was imagining myself, like, 5 years from then being like, oh, I got kicked out of school, and I didn't try. And, like, I was just like, I don't think I could deal with that. And so I started studying a lot, and I was like, I'm just going to study my own way and study the things that I find interesting. And I had a bunch of notes, and I like organized everything really well, and just studied pretty much nonstop for, it was either another month or two, I can't really remember. And I ended up passing, so I did well in my second oral exam, which was great, and I used the same techniques that the director suggested, which was really wonderful. But I think the best part about that was that I was able to I wrote a review about my research topic based on all the notes that I made during that like 2 month period of time. And it was basically like, there's some dogma in the HIV TB immunology world literature, and people are saying one thing is happening, and I think they're right, but where's the data that actually shows that those things are actually happening? And it is literally that review article that my boss and I wrote. I feel like that's the thing that I'm like most proud of with my research, even to date. And it's you know, it's a well-cited review article, and it's basically, this is the stuff that I really, really like, and these are the things that I question in the literature and stuff. And so also when I think about that review article, I also think like, wow, this came from me feeling horrible about myself and just being like, all right, Colin, you need to study the way that's best for you, and don't try to overdo it, just try to focus on the things that you're interested in. And so then that's that, why like I just feel like I feel the best about that article or that review article. And so, yeah, so that was around that time of when graduate school, when I was like questioning things and feeling pretty bad about myself. But it definitely helped out after I passed and stuff. And I still questioned myself, but at least it was more sparingly.
Great. Can we take a break, please?
So one follow-up question about that story. Did your committee know that you had a learning disability? Like, was that something that they knew about?
That's a really good question. My first committee, I didn't want to tell them, because even though I was in a disability, I got accommodations in my classes, I didn't want to tell my first committee. And what I did after I failed it, a new committee's formed, and the one person on the committee stays on. And that was the person that I was talking to before about it, and his name is Dr. Now. And one thing that the director of the Disability Resource Office suggested was, she's like, look, if you need to take more time to answer questions, she's like, just tell your committee. Like, let them know. And she's like, it'll be fine, they won't care, and they'll understand why you're, like, taking a breath or jotting a few things down. And so I am 90% sure that I met with each of the professors before it, and I was like, look, like, I am going to take a little more time, and I'm going to have a pen and paper, and I'm going to jot down a few notes, probably before I answer it, and, you know, it's because, you know, I have the processing issue, and this is just going to help me. And they were, of course, totally fine with it. I guess it's not of course, but they were fine with it, or they appeared to be fine with it.
So you got through this, you know, particularly challenging time in your graduate career. And after that, were there any sort of notable bumps in finishing your thesis, or did it pretty much?
No, I mean, I don't think any PhD thesis is smooth sailing. I mean, some people might be. Yeah, there were a lot of bumps. It's when you're in a PhD program, it's your productivity cycles, and also your attitude towards research can cycle. And there's like an exhaustion period after your comprehensive exam where, like, I immediately wanted to get back into lab and start doing work, but then, you know, I had a few months of just not being productive. But, like, I didn't want to take, like, a week break or something, you know. And so, like, that was definitely not good. There were other times with just, like, since, you know, my writing, you know, is fairly slow. And at that time, you know, it was way slower, especially when I was first learning. And that definitely caused, you know, not problems, but there were definitely issues there. You know, I was in lab a lot, and I didn't, at first I was under the impression that we needed to spend all our time in lab, just because. And there were a lot of times where I would just go into lab, and even on, like, a winter break, and just go in there, and I would be like, okay, I have to be here, and I'd be, like, watching Hulu or Netflix or something. Maybe this is before Hulu, maybe, like, Netflix. I'd be like, all right, well, I need to be here. And, like, that's something that it took me a long time to learn, that, you know, when I'm done with my work, like, I want to leave now. But when I was a graduate student, I was like, oh, well, I always have to be here. But if you decide that, oh, you're going to be at work and only do work, then you're way more productive than extending it out for, like, 10, 12 hours when you can get the same amount of work done in, like, 8 or 10 hours or whatever. And so I think, like, all that stuff was just, like, learning how to manage, you know, like, my time. Another thing, though, that was really hard was, I think, like, as I was saying, like, earlier, I've always been, like, pretty rambunctious, and I'm easily excitable, and, like, I just really like things a lot. And so I had to figure out even how to deal with, like, working in a lab with other people. And so, like, when I first joined my lab, it was a very intense place. And this is even before my comprehensive exam. And there were some people that I didn't get along with, and that it was hard figuring out the right balance, because this, like, new kid comes in and is like, oh, science is cool, blah, 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 and is, like, really wild and is like, oh, this is awesome, you know, like, that type of stuff, which can definitely rub people the wrong way, you know. And I definitely don't, I can't take all the, or it was definitely not just other people's issue. Like, it was definitely me. Like, I had to be like, oh, you know, like, I can't just, like, lay down on the middle of the floor, you know, like, I'm not a small child anymore, you know, like, that type of stuff. But there was definitely, like, that was really hard. And there was a one graduate student, and I just, like, did not get along at that time. And, like, we would yell at each other. It was just not, it was not good. But I have to say, one thing that's really awesome, though, is that over the years, and even, like, towards the end of my career as a scientist and stuff, like, we're friends now. And it's really funny that, like, in 2007, 2008, I would have been like, I will never be friends with her. But it was just like, you know, sometimes people just rub each other the wrong way, and then whatever someone does, whether it's innocent or not, then you get annoyed by it and stuff. And so it was just, it was like a huge, like, learning experience. And I was like, all right, well, I can't, I'm not doing research in a vacuum. I need to make sure that, you know, I'm respectful to other people. And, like, I have to make sure that people are respectful to me. And so it was, there was definitely a balance that had to happen. And it's just, I think it's just really, it's really funny now. And, like, we joke about it and being like, yeah, I remember that time when we really didn't like each other. And so I think a lot of that probably happens just in normal everyday work. But I think as a graduate student, you're a little more stressed. You work a lot of hours. You're working way more than 40 hours a week, and it can be a really intense environment. And that also, that experience also, like, showed me that I want to I want to be a lot more laid back in my research as well.
So when did you finish up your PhD?
In 2012.
And then what did you plan to do after that? Did you already have plans
in
place when you finished?
So before I finished, I did some interviews. And I, because my research project in graduate school was helping develop an HIV-TB co-infection model, and looking at, like, the immunology of tuberculosis and HIV. We were working with a monkey model at the time, and the next logical step for me was moving on to human samples, or to humans. And by samples, I mean, like, tissue samples that are excised from people. And so before I graduated, I lined up a postdoc at the University of Cape Town with Robert Wilkinson. And so that was, I think I agreed initially to a 2-year contract, and then I ended up being there for about 3 years.
And this kind of brings to mind, too, I mean, you had talked about when you were going through comps and the resulting review article that you wrote. What was that sort of, I mean, what were the sort of main questions that you had about this literature on HIV and tuberculosis?
That's right.
I mean, can you tell me more
about
the scientific inquiry you were involved in?
So just, like, some basics about tuberculosis is that, so tuberculosis is a bacteria, and most people inhale it, and so it's aerosolized, so when people cough and stuff. And something really interesting about tuberculosis is that the bacteria can, like, sit in your lungs or go to your lymph nodes, and it sits in your lungs, and your body essentially forms something called a granuloma, where these white blood cells, there's a bunch of different types of them, essentially surround this bacteria in this sphere of immune cells. And what that does is the granuloma's main function essentially is to kill the bacteria and prevent it from disseminating elsewhere in your body, okay? And so most people that get infected with tuberculosis, the bacteria, their immune responses, it works really well. Their bodies essentially form these nice granulomas, and they never get sick. And so literally it's about 10% of the people that get infected end up getting really sick. The bug or the bacteria itself, like, can start, it disseminates a lot. You form a lot of granulomas. The granulomas, just because the granuloma forms doesn't necessarily mean your body is killing the bacteria or killing it enough to prevent you from getting sick. And so when people are infected with HIV, HIV kills certain white blood cells, and a lot of those white blood cells are in that granuloma. And so one hypothesis that was made, and it's a very good hypothesis. It was that, oh, HIV kills these white blood cells, these CD4 T cells, and CD4 T cells are really important to granuloma function. We know if we wipe them out, and you can remove CD4 T cells in monkeys and mice and all the animals through different methods, you know, animals get really, really sick. And so what people were saying was, oh, the reason people are getting sick is because there's killing of these white blood cells, like in the granuloma, and then it's causing the bacteria to grow. And so that was like the first inkling. And I was like, oh yeah, that sounds really smart and that's probably correct. As people progress to AIDS and their white blood cells decrease in HIV, they become more susceptible to tuberculosis. But so I started to like dig and say, okay, well, who actually showed this in the literature? Who showed that there is this reduction of white blood cells within granulomas? And there were just a few papers. And I was like, oh, well, we're making this assumption based on evidence about what's happening in your blood, what's happening in, like, there are experiments where you can put saline in people or in people's lungs and pull them out, and then there's a bunch of white blood cells in them. And there's these reduction of these white blood cells in those areas as well. And so basically a lot of researchers were extrapolating from that peripheral evidence, the blood in the and like the saline in your lungs, to what's happening in the granulomas. And from my research and a lot of the research that was happening in the Flynn lab and where I got my PhD, basically showed that there's very little correlation to what happens in your blood, to what happens in the saline in your lungs, to what happens in the granulomas. And so then I was like, oh, well, this is all based on peripheral evidence. And so the review essentially is broken down into a few different subtopics, and it was like, okay, so we say this is happening in the granulomas, but we're not, honestly, we don't know. Like, I think this is correct, but it's based on this evidence. There are also hypotheses about immunologically what the cells are producing, and I had the same comments. Oh, well, you know, this is what's happening peripherally. Only a few studies have shown contradictory things in the literature that's happening within the granuloma, and I think that basically the literature is as scientists are extrapolating what's happening, and so it basically went through a lot of those things, and something that actually is what I think is really cool is because this is like really my passion area is what's happening in these granulomas. I did as a postdoc, I wrote with a clinician that I was working with. We wrote a systematic review and meta-analysis of the human literature that basically focused on the human studies that actually looked at granulomas in co-infected people, co-infected and singly infected people. And essentially what we showed through this systematic review and meta-analysis was that the literature is very contradictory, and it's really easy to bias your interpretations by just citing a few papers that support your point, and you can support it either way. And so that was something that I really liked. I really, really liked doing, but it was a really hard paper to write because it was a systematic review and meta-analysis. And so we had these specific search terms that we had to like go through, and everything had to be documented what we were doing. And it took a really long time to write. But I really liked it. I felt like it was a nice addition to the first article that I wrote like 4 years before that.
So in your laboratory research, are you pursuing any one of those questions, or you're pursuing several of them, like
yeah.
What are you sort of seeking to add to that sort of layer of human knowledge about this?
And so in my first postdoc at the University of Cape Town, I wanted to know, like, I wanted to do a study looking at granulomas and saying and demonstrating or identifying some correlations of HIV disease and the phenotypic appearance of granulomas, because a lot of the samples I was using were they're from lymph nodes, and they were removed from people for diagnostic purposes. And so everything was saved in a hospital. And so then I just went to the hospital and was able to get those samples. And it took about a year to actually get them, so it was hard. But with that work, I essentially was able to get a paper out that looked at different granulomas from people, and I tried to automate the way that I was analyzing things, just to kind of reduce my bias because of this meta-analysis I was working on. I was like, oh wow, there's so much bias in this literature, and there's not enough information for people to repeat these certain studies. And so I was like, I need to make sure that everything is as straightforward as possible. And so then that was something that I was able to do. And I got a paper out focusing on how these granulomas appear different over different as HIV progresses in co-infected people. So as their white blood cells reduce, is there a correlation of a reduction in white blood cells within granulomas themselves? And I was able to show that. Is there a change in some cytokine, or cytokines are basically molecules that are produced to like increase inflammation or decrease inflammation that white blood cells produce. And so then I was able to show certain phenotypic changes, and that's just like the appearance of them and how they look different and stuff. And so that was something else that I was real proud of, because it was, you know, my first paper that I wrote where it was just based on like my idea and my PI in Cape Town was able to gave me a lot of leeway in the experiments that I wanted to do. And so so that was actually really fun, and I really enjoyed that, but it was a lot of hard work.
What was it like moving from Pittsburgh to Cape Town?
Yeah, it was really hard. I got married maybe 6 months before that. And
what's your wife's name again?
My wife's name's Robin. And we've been together since 2008. So we moved in 2012. Excuse me. And we were just married. And in 2011 we got married. And it was one, you know, it was a big sacrifice, you know, for her to move as well. With me, I was like, oh, I have my dream job. But, you know, she was on a spousal visa, so she couldn't work, and so that was hard.
And what does your wife do?
She's a legal secretary. Okay. At a law firm. And what is interesting, I think, well, what was difficult though is that, so we both moved and it was nice that we were both we had the same experience, you know, and so, you know, we could like, you know, help each other through it. But, you know, neither of us ever lived abroad, and it was honestly the first 6 months of being in Cape Town, I was horrible. Like, I went there as a, like, this is gonna be the best job ever. I'm so excited. I've literally wanted to do this for since probably 2002, I wanted to do HIV specific research in sub-Saharan Africa, in a country that where the effect of HIV is the worst. And so I get there with these really high expectations, and my wife was like, "Oh, okay, well, this will be really good for your career." And like at the time too, my wife, she was diagnosed with depression and anxiety and stuff. And so it was like, you know, it was hard because it was, you know, she was like, oh, well, you know, so like that was just like an extra.
Before you went?
Before we went, you know. And so she's something that she still deals with. And so then that was something that was hard because it was like, okay, well, we both need to find like clinicians as soon as we get there. You know, I need my medication. So I was on Concerta or Ritalin at the time, or Adderall maybe. So that like helps me focus, and my wife, you know, she needed her like antidepressants or like SSRIs, And so then we needed to, like, we had, like, a lot of things we needed to do immediately, and so we were able to do that and stuff. But the thing that I noticed, though, is that as soon as I got to work, everything was really, really slow. And it was much slower than it was as a graduate student. And that's something that's typical as postdocs. When you first start, you're getting your bearings and stuff. But also, the extra hurdle, though, was that I was also getting my bearings living in Cape Town. And, like, Cape Town is a great city, but everything was a little different. And once that honeymoon period was over, maybe in, like, a few weeks or, like, a month, it was like, oh, we can't just keep doing all the touristy fun things. And this is, we are living here. And that was really hard. And so then I started to, like, really be bumming out. Like, I was really bummed, and, like, I really was hating it, honestly. And I went through times where I felt like, oh, well, I'm not going to be able to do the research that I wanted to, because I thought that I could go there and get all these granulomas immediately. But no one was doing that work at that time, so I didn't realize how hard it was. And the people I was contacting for it, like, everything was kind of falling through. And it was also hard because my wife had to, like, adjust to, like, you know, she was at home and she was, like, trying to meet people and stuff. And so as I'm, like, feeling worse and worse, my wife starts getting, she has, like, got, her friends have been really involved in, like, improv comedy here in the States, and so she found this group of people in Cape Town, and then, like, that, like, really made this change that was wonderful. And she also found a wonderful counselor to talk to, or therapist to talk to, that helped, like, modify some medication as well. And so she is, like, starting to feel a lot better, and I am just feeling worse and worse, and I hate it. And I remember, and this is, like, one of, like, I feel like the saddest memories of being in Cape Town, or just, like, the idea of Cape Town, was we lived downtown in Cape Town, and we had this nice apartment, our flat, and there is this window to one of the mountains there, and it was just a beautiful view. It was just really beautiful. And I remembered waking up for, it must have been months, and looking at those mountains and literally, I don't want to curse, but literally just being like, these mountains, and just hating them, and just being like, I can't believe how much I hate this view. And it was just, like, just really indicative of just, like, how I was feeling. And at work, I would, you know, go to work and just kind of sit there, and then I would try to kill some time. I didn't want to do experiments I was doing before, because I wanted to get through, do these granulomas, and they were really hard to get, and I didn't realize how hard it was. I had a really hard time. I mean, I'm very talkative and stuff, but I think for that first 6 months, I was just kind of sit in my corner and chat with people a little bit. And then there were times where I was like, I'm going to go for a walk and just leave my stuff at my desk and just kind of go and, like, sit and just wait for, like, an hour. And then be like, oh, so then people think I'm maybe doing something, and then I go back. Like, it was horrible. So it was cool that, like, my wife's feeling better, I'm feeling bad, and it's nice when you have, you know, someone super supportive and you guys can help each other. But I remember, so that was, we moved in May? Yeah, I think May, at the end of May in 2012. And then we were planning a trip back to visit our families in my family in St. Louis and Robin's family in Pennsylvania. And we flew back and we met we saw Robin's family and we, like, hung out there for, like, a few days, and it was super awesome. Her family is really, really great. And that was awesome. And then we flew to St. Louis, and I remember so we were gone for 6 months, maybe. I don't know, however that math works. We flew back for Thanksgiving. So what is it? June, July, August, September, October, November. Yeah, 6 months. And I saw my family at the airport, and I start to cry. And it was one of those things where I was, like, just so happy to see them, and I was just so unhappy there. It was just a huge surprise to them. I mean, like, we talked a little bit about it. I think it just, I didn't realize like how much like it affected me just being so far away and also being there. So it was a really difficult time. And then I have to say, I think like the next like 6 months to a year, things were definitely getting better and I was making more progress at work. So I was feeling a lot better. But there were also times where like I would like FaceTime with friends and family and just thinking like I don't know what I'm doing here. And there were times where I questioned myself and I was doing it regularly. And there were times too where I like fought really hard, and I feel like fought is the correct word, to get the tissue samples that I needed to work with, those granulomas. And I had to push so hard and push in such a confident way that like, oh, I'm gonna get this, I'm gonna do these experiments, and then they're gonna be done immediately and all this. And I was like, everything's gonna be lined up and it's gonna be perfect, you know, in order to get other people on board. And as I was pushing that really hard, like my sole focus was to get those tissue samples. But then I remembered my boss like sat me down and was like, all right, we figured out where to get these. This is awesome. And my boss was really helpful with that. And I get them and everything's all set up. And I remember that next morning, like waking up and like having, I don't know if I would call it a panic attack, but waking up and just being like, what am I doing? Like, I haven't thought about this. Like, I knew basically what I was gonna do, but I thought that I fought so long for this one thing, and I finally got, I'm the dog, I caught the car, and the car was these samples, and then I'm like, what am I supposed to do with this? And like, I was like, all the experiments that I said I was gonna do, I knew I could do, but there was definitely a lot of time that were like, you have to work things out. And so I was just really scared, and that was something where, you know, I remember my wife, Robin was saying, it was that morning, and like I'm literally looking in the mirror and just being like, what am I doing? And you know, and she's like, you know, you can do this, like this is what you said you wanted to do, and like you finally got it, and you know, it's gonna be hard. You know, and then there was like a slow progression, and then I really, after getting those samples and starting to work on this project, and my wife was feeling really good. She was involved with, she had a bunch of friends there. She's very social, and I'm social at work, but I really like watching Netflix, and you know, that's what I mostly prefer to do. And so it was really, yeah, so it was really awesome. And like, I have to say the last, I think, year and a half that we were there, it was really wonderful. But there was the horrible 6 months. And then, another 6 months. And then we got to the point, and this was actually really nice, I think, conclusion to our time in Cape Town. But we got to the point where, like, my experiments were becoming more and more involved, and there were these new projects coming up. And my wife, Robin, and I like were talking about this, and I was like, if we don't leave soon, you know, I will be here for at least 2 more years, you know. And it was one of those, been here 3 years, it'll either be 3 years or 5 or 6 years. And my current boss, she got an R01 grant, which is a very good grant to get from the NIH. And she was starting a project that was looking at the co-infection, and it was also back in the monkey model that I was working with, or similar monkey model that I was working with in graduate school. And so then I was able, I talked to her about coming back and doing that, or coming back and moving back to Pittsburgh and doing that science again. So yeah, so it was cool. It was a really great experience, but it definitely had a lot of, there were a lot of times that were horrible and a lot of times that were really hard and stuff. So, yeah.
And so you never at any point were like, well, maybe we will just like live here for a while. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like make Cape Town like a longer term home.
Like initially I thought, I was like, oh, well, we could be here for a really long time. We could live here permanently. But that quickly changed. And then after things were really good, you know, I was talking about possibly like having collaborations with University of Cape Town and University of Pittsburgh and trying to figure out a way to, you know, work at both universities. And it's just really complex and difficult, I think, to get something like that done. But it definitely was hard. Or I don't think that after, I don't think for the majority of the time that we were there, we ever wanted to make it a permanent home, or even longer than 3 years. Because 3 years was a really long time, and it's, you know, one of the best experiences of my life. And I think that one of the reasons why it was one of the best is because there was this really hard time at the beginning. And then, you know, my wife and I, we've been together for a really long time. Or I guess it's been 2008. Yeah, so I guess almost 10 years. But at that time, you know, we were married. We had our first to third anniversary, or first anniversary there, or wedding anniversary. And one thing that was really nice, though, is that, like, I feel like it made us closer, because it was either, like, it's either going to be horrible for us or it's going to be great. Mm-hmm. And, like, at the beginning, it was really hard, you know? And, like, when I'm unhappy or she's unhappy, you know, we had to, like, figure that out. But I'm incredibly thankful that we went there. But I'm really glad it was 3 years, and I was like, I have no interest in living abroad anymore.
Got it. So you came back to the University of Pittsburgh in what year?
It's 2015.
Okay. And is that's a time-limited project, 3 years? Or is it kind of open-ended?
Oh, for my current project?
Yeah.
So this was... I'm currently funded on an R01 that's 5 years long. Mm-hmm. And I think there's two more years on it, but there's a new project that my boss just received funding for that is another 5 years. And so I could be here much, much longer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's time. Yeah, everything I think in science is time limited. But it's everything's time limited. If you have funding, then that's great. But I mean, it's hard because it's like, what am I going to do in 5 years when that grant is up? And if I can get funding or my boss can get funding, that'll be wonderful. But if not, then, you know, I'm out of luck. So that's something that's really difficult as a scientist.
Mm-hmm. And what do you sort of, like, what's your sort of vision of the future in terms of, like, what you would like to see yourself doing in 10 years?
Yeah, well, so, like, my fantasy job, all right, so literally my fantasy job would be to become an advocate for people with learning disabilities full-time. And so that would actually be moving out of sciences. But not totally moving out of sciences, with a specific goal of increasing the disability diversity within sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And like if that means that I would be work on policy, and by policy I mean like NIH policy or state policy, or even working with universities and stuff, increasing knowledge about people with specifically learning disabilities, because I know a lot more about it and can personally attest to it, and getting more students involved in STEM fields, like that is something that I would love to do. The hard part about that is there's not much money in that, so you can have all these good intentions, but if I can't feed myself, so what I think what's probably the most likely is I'll continue doing the disability work that I'm currently doing, and writing about it and wanting to, like, you know, get published, and hopefully I can get this book out, and continue giving talks and working with the University of Pittsburgh and other universities. So I've been meeting with a lot of people. So doing that and also being a scientist. Because, like, I have, well, really two passions. And my first passion is this disability advocacy stuff. And my second passion really is science. Like, I love science. I love the pursuit of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I really love the HIV tuberculosis research, because you have these two very diverse pathogens. You have a virus and a bacteria.
and the bacteria doesn't change very much, and the virus changes all the time, and the virus is relatively new. It's a new pathogen to infect people, and the bacteria has been around since, they're found mummies with the bacteria in it. And so you have these diverse things that have just like worked together really well to just have to cause a horrible, horrible outcome, which is just killed so many people. Mm-hmm. And you know, HIV actually is the reason why there was a reemergence of tuberculosis. And so without HIV, tuberculosis might be eradicated or close to it, I think. And so like I love the science of this and also this advocacy stuff. And so right now I'm just trying to be open to I'm trying to stay open in both of these areas.
Are there other groups that are doing advocacy work like you would like to do, or do you want to start your own organization in a perfect world?
Yeah. So both. And so for So the short answer is both. And there is this really cool organization I'm currently working with. The International Dyslexia Association. It's an international organization, but they have a PA branch and an office here in Pittsburgh. I was connected to some of those people, and I'm currently working with them and been taking a lot of meetings and trying to spread the word about disabilities. They focus on dyslexia. My learning disability is a reading disability, and so like some people call it dyslexia, some people don't. I kind of use a more broad term just because, you know, I in my diagnosis it never literally said dyslexia, but it's psychiatrist preference, I think, on what they diagnose. And so that's something that I really want to do. But if I like rewind a little bit, like the little longer answer is, when I was at the University of Cape Town, I wrote an article about being a foreigner being an American working in South Africa on tuberculosis. And I wrote this article, and it was published in a blog that this real well-known journal maintains. And it was on like the tuberculosis day. So this must have been in 2014 or 13. I can't really remember.
What's the blog name?
It's PLUS, so it's Public Library of Sciences, and it was their Speaking of Medicine blog. Okay. And so they have a bunch of journals that are pretty popular. And so I write this article, and I got some pretty good feedback, and I also got some negative feedback because I talked about some of the complications of working at University of Cape Town and how it's harder to do research there than it is to do it here. And so after I wrote that article, I want to write an article about being a scientist with learning disabilities. And I contacted an editor through an editor that I was currently working with. And I wrote that article, and that was definitely in 2014. And that was like really well received, and it literally like I think the title of it was like I'm a scientist with learning disabilities, and that's okay. I think that's the title of it. And what I noticed though was that I ended up getting hundreds of emails from people that were in similar experiences, or just the system didn't work, and by system education system, or they were. They were undiagnosed and they had these issues, or they also had PhDs and they also had learning disabilities, and a lot of engineers and scientists. And so I was like really taken back by that. And honestly, I think that article was the article that whoever from your organization actually contacted me because I wrote that, I think. Mm. And so after I wrote that, I started kind of collating all of the people that are all of like the messages and trying to like figure out like the biggest issues people had. And then I started interviewing a handful of them. I wanted to interview a lot more, but it's just too time consuming. And so then that kind of planted the seed that, oh, well, this is actually a good, actually people might want to hear my personal story, and then I might be able to use that as a mechanism to help like institute change in the like changing like the stigma. Oh, if you have learning disabilities, you're stupid. Like, I don't think that's true. And also helping increase our ability to increase the what is it? To increase the disability diversity within scientific fields. And so then when I moved back to Pittsburgh, I was like, okay, well, I definitely want to pursue this. And so then through a bunch of different meetings and like emailing different schools and contacting people, I eventually got into contact with this International Dyslexia Association. But like before that, I must have sent out 3 or 4 or 5 dozen emails to different organizations, different people, and it was one essentially failure after another, and I was like, look, I have this personal story that I think could be helpful to people. I just want to be able to talk to people and try to help like inspire them to like people with learning disabilities and also eventually like help modify policy, but like I need to walk before I can run. And it wasn't until a few people at this organization actually contacted me and I contacted them and then they responded, and we've been talking a lot over the last like few months, and you know, I want to get more involved in their organization and I want to like learn more about the process and like how to get things done, because I think one thing that's really important is that is changing things within the system itself. Like I don't think saying like, oh, the education system is terrible and it's horrible for people with learning disabilities, and like it can be. But I also think that like the more knowledge people have about learning disabilities, the easier it's going to be for people to excel.
I have really two last questions for you. One has to do with sort of this theme I think that has emerged as you've like talked about your story, which has come up in a lot of the interviews that we've been doing, which is the sort of struggle between, you know, what is sort of expected, or not expected maybe, but what is sort of put upon the individual themselves to sort of adapt themselves to the environment that they're in versus sort of changing the environment to better sort of suit a wider, you know, diversity of bodies or learning styles or whatever. So, I mean, it sounds like most of what has allowed you to be successful has been sort of upon your own, like, adapting yourself and sort of changing how you approach, you know, learning problems or obstacles. So do you want to speak to that at all?
So the only way that it really works, I think, is finding I can only do so much like myself. There are some things that I will always be bad at, and like reading, like even like reading emails, you know, like I essentially skim them, and it's really hard for me to like comprehend all the things that are in them, especially because emails are essentially out of context. They're just short messages, and they're really easy for me to mess up. I have a really hard time like maintaining my schedule, where I have to have everything like written in, like put in my phone. And there's a technician that I work with that actually is really, really good at all of that organization stuff, and it's really nice, and we're friends, and she is like, I will be like, Tara, what are we supposed to do? What are we doing this week or that? And then I'll get like the rundown and stuff. And is it possible for me to do what I'm doing without Tara or without a Tara? It is, but it's also, it takes a lot more like mental energy, and it can be really exhausting. Tara was actually out for maternity leave for maybe a few months. And so that was one thing where I was like, okay, so now I'm going to have to make sure everything is in the calendar. I have to make sure everything is correct. And that definitely took me back. And I was like, okay, I need to deal with this. And so that's a part of me, like, I guess, adapting, like, how I do things, but also saying, like, look, I need help with this. Mm-hmm. And I think also with my current boss, she is, she's also really great, but, you know, like, in our meetings, you know, she'll send me, like, all right, this is the action plan. These are the things that I expect us to get done. And I think that's something that just was really helpful to me. So that is her adapting to me. Even as a graduate student, my committee, when I took that test, they adapted to me saying, like, look, I'm going to need to take a second or two. And a second or two isn't a long time, and that's a very reasonable accommodation. But it can feel a lot. It can feel like a lot of time when you're just standing there and you're nervous. And so then that's them adapting to me. As when I talk to my bosses, like my PIs, my graduate school PI, or even, you know, my current one, there were times where, you know, like, I might need a little more time than the average, whatever that means, the average graduate student, to, like, explain my research or to describe something new. Or I might need to be like, okay, I need to go back and re-explain this. And, you know, it just, I mean, that takes patience on my current boss and even my graduate school boss, you know, when I first learned those techniques. So it's definitely a constant balance. Like, well, you don't need, like, I don't expect everybody, like, I don't want to be coddled, but there are certain things that I'm just really bad at, and even things with, like, I'm looking in a box that has, like, 96 slots in it, and each of the slots has a different vial in it, and they're all written something, and I will be like, so-and-so, can you find this thing? And it's one of those things where it's like, if I look at this, it will literally take me 10 minutes to find it. Someone else can find it in a minute, you know, and they can, like, quickly scan. And so in that light, I talk about my learning disabilities a lot. And, I mean, the way I deal with hard things is I joke about them. But I've learned to, like, actively talk about learning disabilities because I think it's important to, like, increase awareness about them. And if people are fortunate, like I am, you know, there are a lot of people that, like, will help out in those situations. But I think it's also important to not, like, rely on them, like, to make them like a crutch, like something that you actually need.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the things that you just mentioned are sort of these kind of, like, moments of, maybe for lack of a better term, like, moments of crisis where, you know, you're not able to do enough on your own, and so you sort of require that there's, yeah, like, someone else there who's in a, like, position of power or something that can sort of also be flexible. But that's still sort of limiting, like, in terms of, like, structural change, that's not really a massive sort of shift, right? That's sort, yeah, of saying, like, it depends on individual people and, like, their attitudes, which, yeah, which is something, but it's not a sort of, you know, vision of restructuring, like, the way, like, a graduate school training,
yeah, yeah,
might work. So I just wonder if there are things that, like, you've thought about as you're, like, moving more and more into this advocacy realm about how you could just sort of, I mean, I guess along the lines of, like, thinking, like, universal design, but with, like, learning, for learning disabilities, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
like, how could you imagine maybe, like, one thing that you could change sort of at the structural level about, like, the graduate school experience that would just make it more friendly to everyone, and then wouldn't, yeah, have to be these, like, you know, individual, it wouldn't sort of fall on the shoulders of individual mentors or students.
Yeah,
or,
yeah. I think, and this is probably a bad answer, or too abstract of an answer, but I think the biggest thing is just increasing awareness of learning disabilities and getting rid of that stigma. That can't just happen at the graduate school level, because you have so many people that either are failing out or are refusing to continue on or are giving up or changing majors or deciding to not go to college because they feel stupid, because they can't read well. And so that is something that I think, at least, I don't know, structurally, that needs to change overall, just like in societal terms. In graduate school, what I think would help out a lot is there are some scholarships to increase diversity within increase underrepresented individuals, and that includes people with disabilities, but it also includes like people of color, people Pacific Islanders, and so there's also a different there are some diversity scholarships. I think that a lot of people with learning disabilities don't realize that they are allowed to apply to those things, and so I think that, like, at least just increasing awareness about that. I actually contacted NIH about there's a sentence in every R01, every grant that NIH writes, and it essentially says something like, "Oh, people from underrepresented in sciences, and that includes, you know, people of like certain races and people with disabilities and people from socioeconomic disadvantaged backgrounds are always encouraged to apply." And I was like, "Oh, this is great! Like, you know, there should be, because like things like haven't." You know, like even in science, like things aren't leveled off. You know, there's still incredible disparities. But I contacted, and it took a long time for me to actually get like a straight answer. But essentially, NIH uses those grants as a or uses that sentence just for demographic information. So they don't. So I think that there could be more grants. There are some grants that are specific to people that are underrepresented, but I think that there could be a better push for increasing that. Yeah. And that's something that I actually really would like to get involved in. That diversity scholar or fellowship that I'm talking about from NIH, that isn't that's only for graduate students. It's not for postdocs. And so a part of me is like, well, that should also be for postdocs. Like, things don't magically get leveled off once you get a PhD. And I think that's the mentality NIH has. It's like, oh, well, now the playing field's level. And, you know, the playing field is not level. That's some things that I think would be helpful. In addition to that, I think undergraduate schools that are specific for people with learning disabilities would also help out, just because then it would be like a better environment for those students to excel, and then they'd be more comfortable applying for graduate school. But like at the graduate school level, I think it's going to be really, really difficult beyond being able to like put more money in this area and like reducing the stigma, I think, is really important.
One last question that's sort of specific to some of the themes that have emerged from some of the other interviews that we've done, which has to do with like the kinds of technologies or like tools that you've discovered or developed on your own over time to adapt to the sort of abilities that you have in the environment that you're in, right? So yeah. I'm thinking of things that you've mentioned throughout the interview already, like recording lectures when you were a student, and the sort of interesting, you mentioned the Kurzweil 3000 software. Which turns things into PDFs,
It's a text-to-speech software.
Text-to-speech.
That's great,
software.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I'm also thinking about, like, the human support as, like, a kind of a social technology, right? That, like, you've had, you know, key sort of tutors and, like, people who have been your PIs or your supervisors or whatever who have been like, particularly helpful. Is there anything else that you want to mention?
Well, so I think that the technology that helped me, just first technology, the technology that helped me through all my schooling was pretty low tech, because I didn't, like, text speech software wasn't good 10 years ago, and or at least the ones that I tried, or they were terrible. And so it was literally highlighting, typing things up, flashcards, and recording, and just listening to those recordings a lot, and just like putting in the time. And so that was really necessary. You know, it wasn't until recently when I started taking classes again for the Certificate in Disability Law Studies here at the Pitt Law School, I discovered the Kurzweil text-to-speech software. And there's a lot of software, text-to-speech software, that is really good. And it is amazing. It highlights the individual words. It can highlight the sentences while it's reading. You can, like, put notes in the books that you're reading from. All you have to do, essentially, when you're at a university or a university that is a part of some program, and I don't even know what it's called, accessibility program. You buy a hard copy of the book, or you buy a Kindle version of the book, and then they contact the publisher, and then the publisher essentially gives you a PDF of it, and then the PDF is easily readable from the text-to-speech software. And so then that's really awesome, and that was really helpful when I started taking these law school classes, because just law is written horribly. I mean, it's all jargon. And so it was really nice being able to pause and rewind. And by rewind, it's like click back two sentences or go forward two sentences. So technology-wise, I think is wonderful. There's so much more technology available with something as simple as speech-to-text software. I mean, you can do that in Google. You can do that just on your computer, just depending on how good your microphone or the microphone is. There's also a software that is like embedded in pens, and I think there's like Echo Pen is called. I've never used it, but it seems like really cool technology where there's a record of how you're writing, a record of your notes, and that's something that you could use, or even if your professor is like accessibility friendly, then they could do it, and then there's a record of everything that they did and when they did it, and it records everything, like audio and how they're writing. And it's fairly accurate, so it's pretty neat technology. So there's a tremendous amount of technology that's helpful. And technology is only as good as people using it, and so you can have all the technology in the world, but you need to be able to use it, you need to be trained on it, and you need to be able to use it appropriately. But I think the most important thing is, at least for me, and I'm assuming that for most other people, are the people in your life that help you overcome, or again, I don't really like overcome, to help you deal with your disabilities and work with them to achieve whatever goal it is that you have. And so I was incredibly fortunate, and I'm still fortunate, where, you know, my first advocates were my parents, and my brother and sister were also very, very supportive. I always had like supportive friends and could talk about disability stuff or whatever, and we like joke about it, but it was never a big deal. And like I think I said this the last time, the way that I want people to approach people with learning disabilities is like, oh, you have a learning disability? Oh, that's fine. That's it. That's fine. Okay. Like, fine. Your eyes are hazel or blue or whatever gray my eyes color is. So that was wonderful. Going to Bradley University, having a disability resource office where they like essentially force the students to talk to their teachers or their professors about their learning disability. That's important, because then you learn to self-advocate for yourself, look out for yourself. And you know, that they were wonderful. Coming to Pitt when I was a graduate student, I was afraid to admit that I had learning disabilities. I wanted to like go back and hide that. And it wasn't until a single conversation I had with Joanne, who ended up being my PI, and I got my PhD from her lab. But the conversation I had was just about research, and that conversation went really well, and she was so friendly. I have learning disabilities. Are there accommodations I could get? And she sent me to the disability office, which was really great. And even my coworkers have been supportive. They joke that I use learning disabilities as an excuse, and I usually use it for everything if I drop something. But I mean, that's just because of joking about it. But I also, like, the ulterior motive of that is that, like, I think it's important for people to talk about, you know, to be open about it. And I also, I see a therapist too, and it's like sometimes, like, you can have great friends and you can have wonderful, with my wife, she's an awesome, she's, you know, my biggest support, my support network now. Like, sometimes there's, like, you need someone that's, like, outside of your, like, world that can, like, help you out. And, you know, the therapist I see, I think I've been seeing her for about a year, has been great. And, like, you know, something that, like, I never really dealt with depression or anxiety. And my wife actually has bipolar too. And so that's going to be something that's, like, really difficult, especially before we learned, you know, that she had that. It was really hard to, like, deal with, try to figure out, like, what is going on? Why would you act like that? Like, things just didn't click. And so then it literally was like, you know, I feel like I need to, you know, sometimes, like, get help with, like, trying to figure out what's the best way? How is the best way what can I do to be helpful? And, like, how can I learn to, like, say, like, oh, well, this thing happened and I understand that, you know, or this thing happened and that was, you know, sad or hard. And, like, this is something that, like, a therapist is much better at talking with than, like, a friend who's just, like, I don't know, or a parent and stuff. And so I feel like I've been so fortunate that I've, like, built this, like, network of people that are just, like, really, really, really helpful. And I just, I try not to, I really just try not to hang out with people that I don't like, or, you know, there's a lot of people with friends that they don't like, and I'm like, why are your friends? Like, they shouldn't be your friends. Like, get another friend. And so there's just, yeah, so I feel like there's this whole network and stuff that I was able to build over the years. And so that's why I think, even when you mentioned what are the systemic change or the systematic changes that can happen, it is those PIs in a graduate school. They're the ones that are like this, like, first line of defense. If, oh, someone is not reading well or doing something, what's going on? Like, asking them about it, you know? And if a student has learning disabilities and they are diagnosed, being comfortable with that, be like, okay, that's fine. Oh, so you might not be good at a certain thing. That's okay. Let's try to figure out a way to work with that, or try to get you better at it, or something else. And even with, like, other graduate students, like, I was the kid in graduate school. I sat in the front row. I had my digital recorder. It was digital, which I thought was super cool. It was before iPhones, I think. And I, like, some of my friends that eventually who I became friends with at graduate school, because my first semester of graduate school was really rough because I just felt, like, out of place. And but they would joke with me. They'd be like, Colin, we totally just were like, who is this overachiever sitting in front? And I would be like, dude, I'm just trying to catch up to you guys. And so we, like, joke about it now. But but that's something that it's like, you know, being comfortable with it. And, like, okay, someone's recording their lecture. Like, that's okay. Yeah, so I think that the people are the most important thing. And then use technology when you can. That is actually helpful. So,
great. Do you have any follow-up?
That's good.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Awesome. Thank you so much.